take what's there. It's finally the table are starting to turn. Talk about a revolution.
This week in Radical History for the week, starting October 27th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website, and some audio was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the East Side.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This week in Radical History for October 27th, 1889, famed anarchist general Nestor Makhno is born in Ukraine. He would lead the anarchist Black Army against the Bolshevik Revolution. From the song dedicated to his life, quote, "Our flag's black in the wind, black for our sorrow, red for our blood," unquote.
People, the time has come.
This is your radio supporter, Crystal Graham. On this day, October 27th, in 1919, Edmund Goldman, a well-known anarchist and political activist, appeared before federal immigration authorities at Ellis Island to speak out about her deportation order. Goldman had just been released from prison after serving 2 years for opposing the U.S. military draft during World War I. During her hearing, she expressed the irony of a government that waged wars in the name of democracy while it suppressed free speech and criminalized peaceful resistance. Instead, she felt, quote, "Free expression of the hopes and aspirations of people is the greatest and only safety in sane society," unquote. I can get down with that, but I would add that people's free expression of their hopes for their government will also keep us in check. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to never let the past slip away.
Also on October 27th, 1920, in an attempt to get all the radicals out of Philadelphia textile mills, 40,000 workers are fired en masse. Also in the state in 1932, Bing Crosby would record "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?" The recording would enjoy considerable popularity in a year when few Americans could afford to buy records. This downbeat song reflected the plight of World War I veterans, thousands of whom decamped in Washington, D.C. this year. These past veterans, known as the Bonus Marchers, were brutally routed via tanks, sabers, and tear gas one night by forces commanded by then Army Chief of Staff Douglas MacArthur, showing once again how disposable veterans are to the government and how much respect they have for them once they are all done up serving their needs. Also on October 27, 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee calls its first witness to Hollywood loyalty hearings and a grand demonstration of what freedom is really all about in America. Lastly, on October 27, 1990, Muslims, Jehovah's Witness materials, propaganda, and satanic books are burned in Dayton, Ohio by a religious right mob. This week in Radical History for October 28, 1902, in Kansas, working woman, universalist, feminist, and anarchist writer Kate Austin dies. Also on October 28, 1929, stock exchange collapse, Black Friday, starting the Great Depression and world economic crisis. Deja vu all over again. Also on this date in 1965, Pope John VI formally absolves the Jews of collective guilt for the crucifixion of Jesus. Today, I, Pope Michael, do not absolve the Catholic Church of all its historic barbarism in the name of its gods. So mote it be. Today in 1997, a doctor in New York is one of a long string of people injured as a bullet is shot into his home by an anti-abortionist. Most of such assassination attempts are fueled by right-wing hate groups and all in the name of their God. While using religiously fundamentalist ideology, they borrow from groups such as the KKK and Heritage Foundation. Today, 6 Minneapolis residents are facing terrorism charges for the crime of organizing the protests against the RNC last month. Meanwhile, VP candidate Palin would argue that abortion provider assassins are not terrorists in her small, hate-filled, God-loving mind. This week in Radical History for October 29, 1901, Leon Czolgosz, anarchist, electrocuted for the assassination of U.S. President McKinley. His last words were, "I killed the president because he's an enemy of the people, the good working people, and I am not sorry for the crime."
People, the time has come.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 29th in 1929, Black Tuesday, also known as the Wall Street Crash of 1929, occurred, devastating the stock market and causing widespread economic panic throughout America. Although there is debate about whether the crash of 29 was a result of the Great Depression or a cause, it is definitely agreed that it was one of the most devastating stock market crashes in American history. The quick drop in stock prices caused bankruptcies and severe financial difficulties for businesses, The result was mass unemployment and quickly deteriorating living conditions for the American working class, which happens to be a majority of the American population. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
50 years later, 1979, up against the wall, direct action disrupts New York Stock Exchange and the financial district in New York. There'd be over 1,000 arrests. Lastly, for October 29, 1966, the National Organization of Women is founded in Washington, D.C. This week in radical history, for October 30, 1967, Martin Luther King Jr. is arrested and jailed in Birmingham, Alabama, on charges stemming from a demonstration 4 years previous. Quote, I must confess that over the last few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is not the white citizens' councils, nor the Ku Klux Klanners, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice. Martin Luther King. Also on October 30th, at the height of tension over World War II coming, the nation, and especially upstate New Yorkers, start to panic at this broadcast, which you're about to hear part of, which was broadcast live, uninterrupted, 70 years ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity in downtown New York.
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that joins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain's conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Ah, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. Those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute, something's happening. Some shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against the mirror. But there's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. I see them caught up by the woods of fires. Their gas tank tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. We continue now with our piano interlude.
At least 40 people, including 6 state troopers, lie dead in a field east of the village of Grover's Mill, their bodies burned and distorted beyond all possible recognition.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars. The battle which took place tonight at Grover Mills has ended in one of the most startling defeats ever suffered by an army in modern times. 7,000 men armed with rifles and machine guns pitted against a single fighting machine of the invaders from Mars. 120 known survivors. The rest strewn over the battle area from Grover's Mill to Plainsboro, crushed and trampled to death under the metal feet of the monster, or burned to cinders by its heat ray. This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be, the Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the best next thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it. So goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian. It's Halloween.
A small segment from Orson Welles, War of the Worlds, broadcasted 7 years ago on this date.
لم تطئ قوس قزح طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. Whenever possible, we try to feature the Palestinian voice, which seldom is included in the daily coverage of the events in Palestine, Israel. One of those voices is our friend and colleague, journalist Samer Jaber, who writes out of Bethlehem. This morning I want to read the latest piece he sent to This Week in Palestine on the so-called Israel-Palestine peace process. Samer writes, "When Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu stated during his election campaign that there would be no two-state solution during his tenure, the U.S. administration and world leaders were infuriated. The reason for the outrage is that Netanyahu finally exposed the peace process for what it is, a cover used by a world statesman to allow Israel to maintain its occupation of Palestine. Everyone has been acting over the last 20 years as though there is a genuine peace process between the Palestinians and Israelis. Successive Israeli governments and the Palestinian Authority, the PA, held myriad rounds of talks. Media outlets used to trumpet to each round of negotiations. Scores of meetings between civil society organizations on both sides of the 1949 armistice line were held under the umbrella of this process. Innumerable organizations and projects were established and funded to enhance relations between the two communities as they moved towards peace. All and sundry pretended that peace was on its way. The PA president and Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO chairman, Yasser Arafat, from 1991 to 2004, followed by Mahmoud Abbas, the PA president since 2004, have both behaved as though there has been a peace process. For them and for their circle of patronage, without the PA and all its different bodies, there would be no international aid to sustain the pretense and no high-sounding titles for those involved. The PA, which is a self-administration, has been a fundamental element in providing the facade that is the peace process. PA and its patronages made the preservation of the crystallized peace process the raison d'etre of its continuality. Even Ariel Sharon, Prime Minister of Israel from 2001 to 2006, pretended that there was a genuine process. He accepted the roadmap for peace plan, although only after making scores of changes. The plan was proposed by the Quartet on the Middle East, the United States, the European Union, Russia, and the United Nations. Tony Blair, the Quartet's special envoy, went along with all this and behaved as though the peace process was somehow real. But throughout the period of his peacemaker role, he has been able to carry on his own business as usual, adding to his considerable fortune. Successive U.S. administrations have brokered, mediated, and funded projects to nurture an environment in which the so-called peace process could prosper. The Clinton administration in 1999, for example, requested $1.2 billion in additional U.S. aid to fund the deployment of Israel forces out of areas of the West Bank, according to the Y River Memorandum. This took place despite the fact that the Y Memorandum was not enforced at all. Furthermore, in the midst of the Second Palestinian Intifada, when Israel deployed its forces to Palestinian cities in 2002, George Tenet, the head of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and the U.S. Department of State feigned that the peace process was still alive by continuing the PA Israeli security coordination and drafting the roadmap. Even when Netanyahu assumed premier office, everybody acted like there was a peace process. Though Netanyahu accelerated the settlement projects and returned the negotiation process to its first square. Ironically, in 2012, after a long hiatus in negotiation, Netanyahu sent his representative, Yitzhak Malcho, to negotiate with Palestinian champion negotiator Saeb Erekat, a framework for a peace process, as the peace process did not establish a negotiation framework 18 years ago. Same talks took place in late July 2015 in Amman, Jordan, between the Israeli Interior Minister, Silvan Shalom, and Palestinian senior negotiator Erekat, to no avail. When Hamas won the PA Legislative Council elections in 2006, the international community, led by the United States and the European Union, did not accept the election results. Endangering the peace process was cited as the reason. In a 101 negotiation course, students learn that a negotiation should have a clear and defined framework. It should have a timetable marked with milestones. Its advancement is measured against clear, previously agreed parameters. And it goes almost without saying that the mediator should have leverage on both sides to induce them into making progress. The Middle East peace process did not fully meet these basic points, so in reality, there has been no process at all. Paradoxically, after each round of talks, Israel furthered its interests by continuing to expand its colonial settlements and to deepen its security ties with the PA security apparatus to meet its own security needs. Meanwhile, for ordinary Palestinians, the quality of life deteriorates, their security worsens, and land is rolled from underneath them. Moreover, the U.S., which played a key role in brokering the process, was clearly tilting toward Israel and deceiving the Palestinians. The last forward step of the interim agreement was in 1998 through the implementation of the Hebron Protocol, with the partial redeployment of Israeli forces in the city. This agreement really ended in 2000 with the inception of the Palestinian Second Intifada, when many of its clauses, which had been implemented, were rolled back. It had in effect become a permanent framework for maintaining Israel's occupation. The interim peace agreement was a partial transfer of civil administration duties to the PA. Partial because, for example, the PA cannot issue a driving license without coordinating it with Israel's civil administration, the ICA, which is a branch of the Israeli army. Even the president of the Palestinian Authority and senior officials need to travel on permits from the ICA. Israel uses the permit system as a tool to reward and discipline those officials when they use high rhetoric against Israeli policies. Many times the PA premier convoy was stopped by the Israeli forces in areas considered by international law occupied territories, though the convoy usually coordinates its movement with Shabak, the Israeli security agency. All of them pretended that the Palestinian Authority rules the Palestinians when it is in actuality not very different from Vichy France. Meanwhile, as Israel carried out scores of military operations in the West Bank and Gaza, Thousands of Palestinians were killed. The peace process continued. The only people who did not pretend are ordinary people from both communities. Palestinians and Israelis. Israelis who enjoy the fruits of the occupation tend not to care about the existence or otherwise of the peace process. Over the past 20 years, those living in Tel Aviv have been more interested in improving their living conditions. Israeli settlers in the West Bank are interested in ensuring greater government subsidies so they can live as though in Tel Aviv itself. Ordinary Palestinians who live in refugee camps, cities, towns, and villages did not pretend, as for them the peace process has meant further entrenchment of the occupation. They did not pretend because pretense means that some of their numbers are killed in silence, and those who stay alive must adapt to a life in limbo under occupation. It is now time to declare the two-state solution well and truly dead. I believe in a joint struggle led by the progressive Palestinian National Forces and other progressives in the world that will lead to dismantling the Israeli settler political polity over British Mandate Palestine in order to establish one democratic state for all of its citizens that integrates itself in the Arab region. This means for Palestinians a long-term struggle inside Palestine, coupled with international support using BDS as the main instrument. In this process, the Palestinian struggle is anchored to social and national justice, and not only to international human rights standards. That was an article written by Palestinian journalist and activist Samer Jaber. Our feature presentation this morning is my interview with Palestinian activist Bassem Tamimi, who recently came to the Boston area to speak about the Palestinian resistance to occupation, particularly as it relates to the systematic resistance of his village of Navi Saleh. Both he and several members of his family have faced imprisonment, and some have lost their lives in their resistance to the Israeli occupation. Here is my interview with Bassem Tamimi. Okay, well, Bassem, welcome to This Week in Palestine, and thank you for your willingness to speak with us. If there's anything in this country that we need right now, it's the Palestinian voice. Yes. So thank you for coming. Tell us what brought you to the United States and what you hope to accomplish with this whirlwind tour. And in other words, tell us your story, and we'll start with that.
My name is Bassem Tamimi, from the village of Nabi Saleh, 20 kilometers northwest of Ramallah. I born 1967 under the Israeli occupation, and all my life under occupation. It's my second visit to the U.S. and I hope that our voice will be heard, and that may show the reality and may make the attention of the American population about what we are suffering in Palestine, because the American population opinion is very important for us. America is part, the main part of the Palestinian issue, because Israel breathes from the American chest, and for that we need the popular opinion in the U.S. For that, my tour took its importance from the importance of the American population, that we need them, and we try to call our voice here to show the reality, to tell them our story. And I am glad to be here. The American people is so kind and simple. They don't know, and easily when they know, they ask what we can do. They can do a lot, and it's part of our struggle that we are here to holding the Palestinian voice, asking for peace for our homeland, the homeland of the Prophet of Peace.
Hmm. Now, yes, well, tell us about Nabi Saleh and what you're doing there, because that village has become a real bulwark of the resistance, and but its story is not well known here. So tell us about your work in your village.
My story and my village story is part of the Palestinian story. It's an example of what the Palestinian do and what the Palestinian suffering. For that, Nabi Saleh village is 600 person. We live in this village since 400 years. We came from Hebron. We have a settlement named Halmish, control most of our land. We own around 1,200 acre. And 97% area C and 3% area B. 60% of area C is controlled by the settlement. And we have also two checkpoints or two gates on the entrance of the village. One since 2001 is closed, and the other opened from 2001 to 2003 was closed, and then it's partially opened and closed. Now it's closed, and I am now sitting with you, and a lot of clashes in Nabi Saleh, and there is a lot of live ammunition shooting inside the village. We try to call the Palestinian voice. We are a group from the middle leader of the First Intifada, and we see after September 11 and 2003-04, Israel took the cause of our suicide bombing as part of our mistake in that period of time, that we continue in that way of struggle, and make a link between our legal resistance and the terrorists around the world, which harm the image of the Palestinian international community mentality. And Israel started building the wall 2003 and destroying our land and destroying everything. The villages who are using that start non-violent resistance. For that, we start to talk about the best mean for our issue, mean to serve the goal. It's not the goal for itself. And we study our history. We see two periods of time that we need to succeed, and 36-87, which was non-violent resistance. For that, we try to convince our society by this mean to be other option and alternative for the Palestinian, because negotiation will not lead to any right of our rights. And we don't want society to go back to the armed resistance. It's our right, but we can't continue in this way, because our enemy will took it to make other Nakba for the Palestinian. Something else, we study Martin Luther King, Gandhi, South African model, and see it's effective, and it's done a lot. For that, we start our effort to unify all the village that struggle in this way of resistance, and they create a model on Nabi Saleh to show the Palestinian people the idea on the ground. In non-violent resistance, we have the moral power in front of the material power for our enemy. And also, it can unify all the Palestinian society, and it's easy and an opportunity for everyone in the world to do his duty and his responsibility. Every one in the world who believes in the human rights and the human value and see himself a human right defender, he must struggle for our issue. And by non-violent resistance, it's an opportunity. He can't do, I can't do anything. For that, it's more suitable for our issue. And it's can done a lot. We decide to start our model in Nabi Saleh December 9, 2009 to make a link with the First Intifada date, because it's our vision. And since that date, Nabi Saleh, as I told you, small village, this means if a small village do say something, everyone can do. And the culture of resistance is part of our life. We have the high percentage of martyrs in Palestine in this village, 22-1 since 1967. And we had percentage of high education. And our women participate us in all our daily act. And this means the women will participate because real resistance means all the components of the society. You can't keep side by half of our power and say it's a real resistance. Our role of the women is more important in the struggle because she was responsible for all the daily life needs when her husband killed or be in the prison. Right. And also the woman role is more important because she growth the children. Strong, free woman, strong and free generation will lead to freedom and liberty.
Now, tell us, where is Navi Saleh in terms of the wall? How close, where, how does it relate to you?
This is part of our strategy. We haven't wall in Navi Saleh. Because our problem, we start in Navi Saleh to indicate about other shape of the occupation. It's the settlement.
Mm-hmm.
Because our problem is not the wall. The wall is the face of the problem.
Right.
The settlement is the shape of the problem. The problem is the colonization in Palestine. The problem is the occupation. For that, it's not a react for the wall. This is why I said it's different. Because there is no specific goal. Our goal is to indicate for the mean to be strategy and believe against the occupation in all its shape and forms in our land.
Now, so the settlers have come in and taken your land, a good bit of it agricultural. So what you're facing is not only issues with the Israeli military, but the impact of that settlement on your village, your land, your ability to make a living. Tell us a little bit how the settlers impact in terms of when they challenge you or when you go out to try to work in the fields. What is there a lot of conflict?
As I said before, the settlement is part of the or the shape of the problem, the occupation. In our land, in Navi Saleh, the settlement started in 1976. Since that date, we have clashes with these land settlers.
Mm-hmm.
Every time, we have clashes with them. Every time they extend and expand their fence, or attacking the farmer, owner of the land, who are working in their land. And every time, they threaten and scare the Palestinians to be away from their land. Since they started, we haven't any normal relation because the settlement is a normal issue on our land. For that, they do a lot of violence against the Palestinians. For example, in the last 2-3 years, they cut and burned more than 400 olive trees. They destroy the fields.
Are they trying to expand?
Yeah.
They're continuing to try to expand
and
their land.
Yes.
So they're okay, and so people from your village that go out to work their land are finding increasing problems with the settlers coming and taking their land. That continues to this day.
Continue until this day. After the second intifada, 2001, they extend the fence and built other small settlement and all the land in between, nobody can work and go to harvest his land or collect the olive trees fruit. The last attack before 2009, they came and stole small water well, spring.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that Palestinian water is very problem. It's a problem of water is very complex. The Israeli makarot control 38%, 83% of our underground water. And for example, Nabi Saleh has example of the water problem. We just have 12 hours supplied water weekly, and we took water from the same pipe that give Halmish. Halmish took every 24 hours daily. And this is all, because the water is a problem, we store the water on the roof of the tanks. And sometimes, a lot of times, the army come and shoot the tanks, which become empty. For that, we used to go to this spring to bring some of water for drinking and for the rest of the week. 2009, they go out to the fence, yeah, and took this small spring. And they destroy, start creating and scaring any Palestinian come there to go to work or to plant some vegetables or to work in his land. And by their dogs, shooting live ammunition, destroy the Palestinian agriculture, and they start became naked around the pool. And you know our culture, nobody can talk his wife and daughter to when the naked people are around him. This is type of their creating a scare in the Palestinian. For that, we decide to go to protect the farmer and the owner of the land in their land and work with them. We march the street December 9, 2009 as a specific goal that we got to protect the farmer. Then we face the army. And every time, every Friday, when we try to go to work in our land, we face the army shooting rubber bullets, tear gas, all the weapons that they have against us, which make the Palestinians suffer more and more and more.
So every Friday, you are going out to your fields.
Yes.
And the settlers, and both the settlers and the Israeli military,
yes,
are there to, quote, protect the settlers who have taken your land. I mean, that's the picture we get. Is that
the picture you get? Yes.
Yeah.
If you see the view, you can see the settler playing and swimming on the pool on our spring. This is every day, or working on the land, or playing, just playing to make the Palestinian nervous. And we try to go to the land, or we try to the gate, to open the gate. This is the specific goal. Then we face the army. The army shooting what he can shoot. Since that date, to make it clear what we suffer since around 6 years, we have two martyrs, Rushdie Tamimi and Mustafa Tamimi. Yeah. We have more than 90 prisoners. 90 of them children under 18, 9 under 15, 16 women. We have more than 350 injured persons, 40% of them children, 50 of them is disability in part of their body. Not all of them from Nabi Saleh. We have our partner from the other villages. And we have 13 demolition order for houses located in Area C. This means 80% of the village under the demolition order. This controls the extent of the village. We can't build. For that, the shape of the village changed and it start extend vertically, which means the shape of the village is destroyed. Also, if they don't demolish, or they demolished last before 3 months a home for American resident, and he have a permission from Jordan government, Jordanian government. This means that they will send us. We know we're nobody over the law. The American residency will not help, and also the permission from Jordan will not help. This means that I can't use my land in Area C. I can't build another floor for my children in my home because I have demolition order. I can't take the risk. This means my four child will be replaced to Area B or Area A or outside Palestine. It's a silent ethnic cleansing in Area C. Area C, 62% of the West Bank. there are just 60,000 Palestinians and more than 400,000 settlers. Mm-hmm. It's a silent ethnic cleansing, just like a demolition order. The world see demolition order because it's, they said it's illegal. Mm-hmm. But the demolition order effect and impact is that it's destroy the existing of the Palestinian Area C.
So your home is in Area C. Area C is completely controlled by Israel. Will not allow any building, will not allow you on your own land to have a permit to build your house. Yes. And if you build your house,
they will destroy it.
That is what you face. Tell us about, so many people are arrested, Palestinians are arrested under what's called administrative detention by the Israeli military. Tell us about administrative detention and its use by Israel as a means to control and to get information from Palestinians.
For me, I had been in jail 9 times in my life. Mm-hmm. 7 times of this is administrative arrest. Administrative arrest is just, this is because they feel or they, somebody say or feel that you maybe do something. For that they took you to keep you in prison for a long period of time. Sometimes they give you 6 months, and after the last day, on the last day they extend the 6 months for 6 months, and 6 months for 6 months. My friend stay 9.5 years as this type of extending the 4 months and 6 months, 4 months and 6 months, every day, every time they extend and renew the decision to keep the Palestinian inside the prison. This type of arresting comes through the British law. Since the British occupation. It's used, but in the past they used it just for 3 months, 2 months, 6 months. But the Israeli used it for a long time. As I told you, more than 9.5 year for a person. Also, you know that the punishment is not just for the prisoners. You feel that how your family, once I was in the prison, 2003-04, and I prepare myself to go out of the prison the day that I must be free. I talk with my wife to prepare food and everything. I am coming and talk with we have some phones, that illegal phone, for example. Yeah, and I told her that I am coming, but prepare food. They come and give me another 5 months. You see how it's affects the children and the family and every time like that.
So under administrative detention, there are no charges, specific charges filed against you. You're not given a court date to defend yourself against these allegations. You're just under administrative detention. You're just held and can be held and held and held and held indefinitely. Is that...
You know that the Israeli legalistic system and the court is just a makeup for the face of the occupation.
Right.
They use to have you have two courts. The first one, you go to the court and say, yeah, yes, it's continue. And the other court, it's just what they are saying it's a secret file. A secret file means the lawyer can't see what is the charge against you. For that, by the secret file, which comes through the intelligent, through the collaborator, your life is just because somebody don't like you, for example, in the village, and collaborator, for example, in your community, and write any report that you do, maybe will you do something. For that, the judge take the security file, and through this file they continue extending and extending. Hmm. The file is built by the intelligent, and the intelligent can write what they do and they believe and what they feel. For that, it's just a show. It's not the court.
We hear stories about how administrative detention is used to force people to become collaborators. They threaten people personally, but beyond that, they threaten their families. And administrative detention, among other things, is a way to try to get pressure people to become collaborators. Is this a major problem for the resistance?
The collaborator is the major problem for any revolution in Denmark. Yeah. And they use all the Palestinian need and times to put the pressure for some weak people to make them collaborate. Mm. Part of it, the arresting. Yeah, not just for the administration, all type of arresting.
Yeah.
All you, in the, or any need you need. If you need a permission to go to work to make the income for your family. Or if you want to build a house. Or you, anything you need from them, they can make a deal with you.
Okay, so we'll give you a permit.
We give you a permission. We give you.
And we want information from you. Yeah.
Or sometimes in period of time, they put cameras in the dressing house to film the women, and they put the pressure. They do everything they can to harm the Palestinian existing and life in Palestine.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned your commitment to nonviolent resistance. Mm. Palestinians have a long history of nonviolence. I'm wondering how you feel about this as a strategy, whether it is working in any way, whether you see any hope through this strategy. Things seem so dim right now, and I think the resilience of the Palestinian people is something that we deeply admire, but just wonder how you're feeling about things right now in terms of week in and week out, every Friday, resisting this, facing the settlers, facing the military. What's your vision for the future in terms of
a strategy?
Yeah.
As I told you, we create the model to indicate for this type of resistance to be an option and opportunity for the Palestinian, because the negotiation will not lead to our right. And we don't want to go back to our resistance. Until now, we haven't the strategic nonviolent resistance, because it's just a models or some villages who act in this way of resistance. It became a strategy when it's distributed in all the Palestinian land, territories, and society, like the First Intifada. Our vision is the First Intifada. And during the First Intifada, it was the main model for the nonviolent resistance. Now, we succeed, for example, to make it more common, more acceptable in the Palestinian society. More than 70% believe that it's the most effective way of resistance. Fatah movement, as the big Palestinian political party, took it as a strategy in the last conference for Fatah movement. Hamas and Fatah in Doha dealing, when they have a dealing, they took it as a strategy for the period of time to be strategic way of resistance. Now, if you see it since a week or more than a week, the Palestinian, they have a popular struggle in Intifada. All the Palestinian land now, every place, Jerusalem, Hebron, Haifa, Yaffa, every Palestine, are acting in the non-violent way of resistance. And this means maybe this uprising, the third Intifada. I hope that it will be the third Intifada. But I think it's just something locally and will not continue for a long time. We hope it will be the third Intifada, and the world took their responsibility and start acting as the Palestinian acting on the ground to isolate Israel as an apartheid state and for me, I believe in the one state solution.
Mm-hmm.
Because Israel, 22 years of negotiation took time to destroy on the ground the one state solution, which became acceptable in all over the world. They destroyed the opportunity for the one state solution. For that, we must go forward a step and see the South African model to make the state for peace, for everyone believe and want to live together and take the same right for everyone who live in that, in the Holy Land. And one person, one vote, it's mean same right, equal right, and everyone can feel his dream is existing on the ground. When they asked me why, I told them, my child like to go to beach. If they are in a barrier between them and their dream, the beach from Nabi Saleh, 25 kilometers. And they can't best to see the sea. It's mean the right to return to refugees, there is no solution without ending the suffering of the Palestinian refugees.
Let's talk politics for just a few minutes. What do you think needs to happen politically to bring the Palestinian people together to perhaps have a new election, find new leadership? Seems to me personally there needs to be new leadership. Do you think that's possible in the near future, or is this still a long ways off?
For the division you're talking
about. Yeah.
The election, is Israel need to be to take the Palestinian the opportunity to be unified, or Israel want them to be divided?
Mm-hmm.
Israel
right.
want to be divided. For
right.
that, it will not give the situation to be ready for the election. Also,
right.
the election itself, the result of the election, Hamas or Fatah, the percentage will change. Just the percentage. For me, the main and the suitable way to be unified, the Third Intifada.
Mm-hmm.
If we make a unified leadership and make civil resistance to end the Israeli occupation, this means we will be together and we will work together to end the Israeli occupation. In that time, we will be unified. But if we talk about the authority and the interest, we will never be unified, because the authority and the interest make everyone want to keep his authority in his hand.
Let's take a look at the Palestinian Authority. Many see it as an arm of the occupation, frankly. It is used to control the Palestinian people. Yet many people depend on it for their jobs, and it looks like it plays a role in the Palestinian economy, just the money that comes through and comes to families and supports families. And so you have this crisis, really, between... So I would be interested in your thoughts about the Palestinian Authority. Some talk now about, well, perhaps we should give up Palestinian Authority, just throw ourselves at Israel. Israel's going to have to do something. Others say, no, the authority really, really plays this economic role, et cetera. We can't do without it. I would just be interested in your take on the authority and its future and the role it plays in the society today.
Palestinian Authority comes after Oslo Agreement. And
right.
it's a step to be the government for the Palestinian state after 5 years. And the Palestinian state, as a goal, it's destroyed by the Israeli government and the Israeli bulldozers. This means the legalisticity of the authority for, in the Palestinian mind and mentality and feeling, it's loose, because we took it to be a step to have our state and independency. If we will have it, our state and our independency, the legalisticity of the authority will be away, this one. Other thing, part of our mistake that we took from the shoulder of the occupation, their responsibility for all the Palestinian need and want services, and take it on our shoulders. Mm-hmm. This is the responsibility of the occupier
right.
for this one. Other thing, the Palestinian income is decreased. The per capita income before the First Intifada, it's better than today. And this means that the economic issue is back. It's not go forward. Part of the problem that the authority deal with all the projects that come for the development project, in with the occupation and the stable issue. For that, there is no thing happened in Area C, because it's under the Israeli control. Now, if we, and the problem that sometimes the people see that the authority is the leader or the political leader for the Palestinian issue. The authority is the services, the administration for the Palestinian need. It's not the political issue. PLO who is responsible for the political issue. If the political issue is not having any opportunity to happen anything for the Palestinian right to be, to have a state, it's mean the authority will but not be needed. It's the responsibility for all the world to the daily life for the Palestinian. Mm-hmm. We can't took the our income as a soul in our head that we can do something for our issue. We are searching for our independence and freedom and justice and dignity. We are not searching for our salary and for to make our ways as a highway. We don't want the life under occupation easy. We want to end the occupation. Mm-hmm. For that, I think the authority re-identify the authority rules. It's just for the Palestinian services, and the world must be responsible for that, and the occupier must be responsible for that, and go forward together with Hamas and all the Palestinian party to make a unified leadership and a program for a liberation project to end the occupation. For me, we must go forward to talk about the one-state solution and isolate Israel as apartheid state. This is the time to talk about our human rights and human value and human freedom, justice and dignity and all what we need.
Well said. Very well said. We have just a minute or so. I want to go back to you. You touched on this a little bit earlier, but I want to end with it. And that is what we in the United States need to do to support your resistance in this terribly destructive occupation. What do we need to do?
I told you we became the victim of the victim after the international community saw the result of the Holocaust on our land and from our account. For that is a responsibility for everyone in the world to do his duty and his responsibility. It's not a gift. It's a duty and responsibility. Your country paid $10 million daily for the Israeli army. Most of your military industry in your country comes to be experimented in the Palestinian lab from the Israeli. And for that, Israel is the guard for the interest of the capitalism and the imperialism. This means that we all together have the same enemy. It's the military industry and the capitalism way of thinking. In America, that's the main battle is in America. You can put a lot of pressure on your government. You can make the BDS against all the Israeli product. You can go forward to come to Palestine and show you the reality. Media now is not controlled by the Zionist and IBAC. And you can do by social media, show the reality for everyone in the world. It's the time for the American to be free from the controlling of the IBAC and the Zionist, who control media, and take the responsibility and bring the peace and justice and the freedom as a gift from the American population for the Palestinian child, because we don't want just to see the airplanes comes from America to destroy our life.
Well, thank you for that. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. You have a lot of work to do, but we have a lot of work to do here. Yes. And working together and having these relationships means a lot to us, and I think is very helpful. So again, thank you for coming. Thank you for sharing your story with us. And we'll follow you, and we'll be in touch, and hopefully the future will be brighter.
Thank you, and I need to give me the opportunity to call the Palestinian suffering and voice, and I would like to thank all the American population for their kindness and and feeling, and we see, we say that maybe from your eyes and your effort will be the bridge that we pass for our dreams and hopes.
Hopefully. Well, thank you very much. Thank you. That was Bassam Tamimi from the village of Nabi Saleh, speaking about the resistance to the Israeli occupation in Palestine. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, unwelcome guests.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you. My shining, on my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're listening to episode 724 of Unwelcome Guests, calling a scad a scad. I'm Robin Upton. Now, you may be wondering what a scad is. Well, a scad is a state crime against democracy, and crimes perpetrated by criminals are worthy of punishment. That's quite a different frame than the rather ill-fitting CIA-framed term conspiracy theory. This week we begin our radio adaptation of the best movie ever made about Operation Gladio, Alan Frankovich's famous 1992 expose from the Time Watch series. That movie is 2.5 hours long, so inevitably it's going to take more than one episode. We're going to begin with a talk. This is from September the 6th, 2013. It's a soundtrack of a YouTube video, very slightly edited to remove inaudible bits and improve audio quality in various places. But I shall link to the original download from this episode's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/724. The speaker is Professor Lance DeHaven Smith.
I thought there would be investigations after the 2000 election and that the crimes that were committed would be prosecuted or at least made known. And what happened instead was people were told, just move on, get over it. You know, there was an investigation, but it was set up so that it said the inquiry was about the technology and it wasn't about the partisanship in the election administration. Have you seen this movie, Recount? It goes over, well, they're actual crimes that are displayed in the movie, but you don't know they're crimes unless you know the law. On the morning after the election, after Election Day, the general counsel, the lawyer in Governor Jeb Bush's office, called the five largest law firms in Florida and told them that the governor didn't want them working for Al Gore. And they didn't work for him. He had to hire an attorney from out of state. They got boys. And this is reported in the movie. It's just kind of a matter-of-fact thing. But the reality was that was a felony. That was use of public office for coercion. They were threatening these law firms with loss of business if they took on Gore's case. Well, there were many crimes like that committed during the 2000 election, and nothing was done. And even the movie Recount, you know, it shows James Baker. He comes across as this real tough guy who's, you know, really competent, And Warren Christopher, the leader of the Democratic of Gore's campaign, comes across as this wimp who gets, you know, pushed around by Baker. The reality was Warren Christopher was following the law. He was doing what the law said. He wanted to do the right thing, and Baker was abusing the law. So it was very frustrating seeing this. And I wrote a book about the 2000 election and specified the crimes that were committed. It was published by the University Press of Florida, an academic book. Got relatively little attention, but it laid the facts were there. But when I saw that nothing was going to happen about it, I started studying this topic. And I came up with this term, state crimes against democracy. I have a definition for it. Concerted actions or inactions by government insiders intended to manipulate democratic processes and undermine popular sovereignty. It's a terribly turgid definition. The way I developed it was I did a list of what these suspicious events are. There's some that we know, there's no dispute about the Watergate break-in, the crimes of Watergate, the Iran-Contra scandal, the outing of Valerie Plame, the lying us into war in Iraq. This is all documented. So we know that there are these high crimes to subvert democratic processes. But I did a list that included others that we suspect that. The Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Robert Kennedy, George Wallace, the attempt on his life, the attempt on Ronald Reagan's life. The 1968 October surprise. I'll tell you about what these are. But anyway, it was a long list. It was like 20-something events, about a third of which were well-confirmed and others we were suspicious about. And I extrapolated from that list to come up with this definition. The basic idea was to have a name for the type of crime that the term conspiracy theory discourages us from speaking about. If we can't name the crime, it's very hard to discuss it. And I was thinking about it like white-collar crime or juvenile crime. We needed a name for this kind of crime that we could then study and get, you know, basic ideas about the profile, who commits these crimes, what are the institutional vulnerabilities. I say actions or inactions. When there's a stand-down like there was on 9/11 appears to be, where people don't defend the country, That's a SCAD. That's a crime in itself. It's a treason, a form of treason. The Vietnam War was started on a false pretense. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was passed. We had our gunships off the islands of North Vietnam, and we were firing on these islands, large cannon fire. And then when the North Vietnamese would come out, we would race back to international waters. Our ships reported they were attacked in the summer of 1964, and they said that they were doing nothing. They were in international waters minding their own business. And so the administration lied to Congress and got that war started when it was really a provocation or a kind of an inaction. I use government insiders because it isn't always the case that it's somebody in government. It can be a political insider. I'm thinking about Nixon. Nixon, in 1968, was running for president. And there were peace talks going on between North Vietnam, South Vietnam, and the United States. And Nixon thought if they made peace, that he would not win the election, that Hubert Humphrey, the Democratic candidate, would win the election. And so he sent word to North Vietnam, to their president, saying, stop, withdraw from the peace talks, and I'll get you a better deal. That's a treason. I mean, what the man did was treason. The reason we know about this is because Lyndon Johnson, we have a taped telephone call between Lyndon Johnson and Everett Dirksen, a U.S. senator, Republican leader at the time. And Lyndon Johnson knew that Nixon had done this because he had wiretapped Nixon's plane. His campaign plane. Yeah. I mean, these guys, I mean, they do all this stuff. I mean, Mission Impossible, you know. I mean, this is what these people do. This came out in 1997, and Johnson is talking to Dirksen, and he says, I can't believe he's done this. He sabotaged the peace talks. This is treason, but I'm not going to tell the American people because it would destroy their faith in their leaders and their country. So we learn about this in 1997. It's in the news one day. You know, and this is these events, they eventually, many of them, they eventually become known, and we understand the dynamics of them and who was involved. But it's often long after the event. It receives very little attention, and there's no effort to go back and rewrite history with the awareness of this. But anyway, the point was Nixon was not in office, but he was a political insider, and he was doing this as an anti-democratic high crime. I've written a number of articles about this. I won't belabor this much, but I wanted you to know I first wrote about it and defined the state crimes against democracy concept or construct in 2006. And I started working with this guy, Matthew Witt. Matthew T. Witt is a professor at Laverne University in California. And I have to tell you, when you accept that John Kennedy was assassinated by the government, and the evidence is very strong for that. At the very least, the government covered up that it was a conspiracy. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And once you come to understand that, you should rethink how you think about American government. From then on, you should say, well, you know, these guys are capable of some pretty outlandish things. But my tendency was I would admit this about Kennedy. I would admit Watergate. Everybody knows Watergate. I think we tend to minimize it. Watergate is called the Watergate burglary. It was actually a wiretapping. And the people who were arrested were going back in to the National Democratic Party headquarters. They had wiretapped it 3 weeks prior. And they were they had transcripts and they were reading them, but one of the wiretaps went out, so they were going back into the National Democratic Party headquarters to replace that wiretap, and they got arrested. The two principals, Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy, worked for the White House and were consultants for the Committee to Reelect the President. They had planned to kill Jack Anderson, an investigative reporter, and Teddy Kennedy, and they had monitored Teddy Kennedy's activities, but the plan was called off. There are many other things. I mean, when the Watergate, when the guys were arrested, Howard Hunt sent his wife, Dorothy Hunt, to the White House to tell the White House, look, all of these people that have been arrested in Watergate have obligations. We have mortgages to pay. We have kids in college. We expect our expenses to be covered. They said if you're in the CIA and you're arrested overseas, they take care of your family. And they felt like they were working for the president. They thought it was a legitimate operation, and they should be covered. Nixon referred to it as hush money. He understood it was blackmail. But John Dean speaks about Dorothy Hunt and says that she was just a completely savvy person, that she was, you know, wife of a CIA agent and had gone all over the world. And she had been a CIA agent in France before she married Howard Hunt. Well, Dorothy gets several hundred thousand dollars for the Watergate burglars, as they call it. They call it the Watergate burglars because the day after it happened, the press secretary of the President Nixon said, this is a third-rate burglary attempt. We had nothing to do with it. It's just a screw up by these overzealous campaigners. And we call it a burglary to this day when it was espionage at the highest level, you know, attacking the opposition Democratic Party during a presidential election. What I wanted to tell you about Dorothy Hunt, though, was she was on a plane flight to Chicago with $10,000 in cash to disperse, and her plane crashed, and she was killed. There was a grand jury impaneled in Chicago, and they brought Robert Haldeman in to testify because they thought it had been that he had killed her, that the Nixon people had killed her. There was no evidence, and all they did was make him testify, and then they let him go. We know this in part because Haldeman tells this to Nixon in the White House, and we have it on the White House tapes. But the point is, Watergate was more than a burglary. I mean, we're talking about a crime spree of fairly wide proportions. The break-in to Howard Hunt's psychiatrist's office, Howard Hunt's Ellsberg's psychiatrist office. There were 100 break-ins like that around Washington at that time, where the people's psychiatrists had their files rifled when they were providing service, psychoanalytic services to very important people's wives or husbands. So Watergate was, you know, this massive crime spree. Witt got me thinking about it in those terms. You know, he would say, I would say, well, you know, Nixon was crazy. I thought of Nixon as a, I mean, I think most of us do think about him as, you know, he was paranoid and nuts and a gangster. It took me a while to get used to the idea that a lot of them are like that. It's not just him, you know. So he helped me with that. We wrote an article in 2010 that was published in the American Behavioral Scientist, which is a fairly widely read journal. And it got, there was an op-ed that was written by Mickey Huff, some guys at Project Censored. They said that they wrote about this study and they submitted it to an online website that they had published other things in, and they were told they would not publish this because it was on conspiracy theory. And they were stunned. I mean, they said, this is what we do. We publicize things that are being stifled, and we had this outlet, and they told us that we couldn't publish on that. But I don't think many people would have read it if these guys hadn't publicized it. I wrote an article on the Nuremberg War Crimes trials, and this was kind of shocking to me to go back and read about this. I was teaching a class on international conflict and international law, and so I read the Constitution, I read the UN Charter, and I read the War Powers Resolution of 1973 and the 2001 authorization to use military force against the people who planned 9/11 and the 2002, and what I found was we break the law all the time, okay? I mean, when we threaten Syria, that's a violation of the UN Charter. We are signatories to the UN Charter. Our Constitution says our treaties are the highest law of the land. They're higher than the law. They're higher than the Constitution. And that treaty says we're not going to invade people unless we're being attacked. And we have to get a resolution from the United Nations to continue, even if we're attacked. We have to get their support to continue it. But we violate it all the time. Well, I went back, I said, you know, let's look at the Nuremberg War Crimes trials. And to my surprise, what I found was that the first charge in the indictment of the Nazi war criminals was a conspiracy charge. They had conspired to overthrow the parliamentary government in Germany, and then warmonger and strike fear into people's hearts, and then start an aggressive war against other countries. Do you know what we did to these people? We hung them. They included not only politicians, they included diplomats who were fronting for the Nazi war of aggression. They included journalists who were warmongers and anti-Semites. They included lawyers. We prosecuted these criminal cases because we are, you know, after the war, Stalin said, let's kill all the officers in the Nazi army. And Churchill said, no, we can't do that. Let's kill 20,000 of them. And it was kind of glib, but that's really what they said. And the Americans said, no, we have to teach a lesson to the German people. We have to show them what their leaders did, and we have to show them that they have a responsibility as citizens in an elected representative democracy to not let power be consolidated and to never let this happen again. The Germans have learned that lesson pretty well. I mean, they're very cautious about what they do in foreign policy. Yes, ma'am.
I was just
going
to say, I'm sorry to interrupt your
question.
My name is Kathleen, and I think that Nazi Germany never really ended. Just a show was put on, and they've been transferred here.
Well, there's an operation called Paperclip, where we brought in their intelligence apparatus, basically wholesale, into the United States. And what I did in this article was simply compare what the Bush-Cheney administration did in terms of twisting the intelligence and telling people that we were going to be potentially that this country was trying to build nuclear bombs and had weapons of mass destruction and they could give them to terrorists and we were in peril, when they knew otherwise. They knew otherwise. They, you know, the torture that we talk about, the torture occurred in August of 2002 at Guantanamo Bay. There were two people tortured, and they were waterboarded like 186 times. I mean, it was a horrendous thing. But what they were doing was trying to get confessions linking 9/11 to the Iraq, to the country of Iraq. And once they couldn't get that, they stopped it. There was Abu Ghraib and all that. That was different. This was torture that came right out of the White House. So anyway, I did this article and said, if you look at what the Bush-Cheney administration did and you compare it to our charges against the Nazis at Nuremberg, you'll find they're parallel, almost exactly. Bang, bang, bang. I could not get that published in the United States. I had it reviewed at one journal three times, and the reviewers kept saying, this is a great article. This is an important article. We cannot publish it. Literally, I'd never seen anything like this. I submitted it to Contemporary Politics, was the name of the journal, and they published it right away. It's published in London. It's a British journal. It taught me a lesson about what we're up against. It, science is supposed to be a search for the truth. It's not an organ of legitimation for the power structure in America, but that's pretty much what it appears to be because it was too controversial. I knew the editor. He was a good friend of mine. He kept trying. He wanted to publish it. And he would send it to three reviewers every time, and we would get these split decisions with a very strong, we can't publish it. I had submitted another article, the one that got published in the American Behavioral Scientist, I submitted to Public Administration Review, the major journal for the American Society of Public Administration. It was reviewed, and two reviewers said we should publish it, and one reviewer said don't. That's a split decision, and the typical thing is they have you make revisions and then publish it. Well, I made the revisions, resubmitted it, and the editor writes me back and says, we had one of the reviewers who had said publish change his mind, and he said don't publish it. He said it was too good for their journal. Honest to God, he said it's too good for our journal. I went to the editorial board meeting that year, and it was in Miami, and complained about it, and this was the only time this had ever happened in the history of the journal. And the editor apologized to me at the meeting. He said, but that's the way it goes. I mean, we're not going to overrule the reviewers. Well, and what I assumed, being a conspiracy theorist, that there had been a conspiracy to keep this from being published. But I've had some interesting experiences with all this. But the reason I tell you about it is you're probably not aware of the academic background on it. And there's a pretty good body of research now that establishes that there are these kinds of crimes. They need to be looked at comparatively and collectively together so you see patterns in them. And that you can't depend on the government to... There are a number of reasons I'll go over why we can't depend on the government to give us the truth. There's a book from Paul Gray MacMillan on state crimes against democracy. That's the title of the book. So the term's getting out. That just came out about 3 months ago. And then this book I wrote because a friend of mine, Mark Crispin Miller at New York University, asked me to write it. I had written a chapter on the 2000 election for a book of his, and it was like 2006, and he said, you ought to write a book on this. And so I really appreciate his help in helping me frame it. I won't belabor this, but I just want to point out that SCAD is not a conspiracy theory. It's not a term for that. It's a term for the crime. We wouldn't say white-collar conspiracy, you know, or white-collar theory. We would say white-collar crime. And it's the same way with state crimes. You have to think in terms of crimes, not theories of crimes. I think you all know that it's a pejorative term. The problems with the term conspiracy theory, it's a totally nonsensical term. The way it's used is anything that is suspicious of government insiders conspiring to subvert democratic processes is considered ludicrous, paranoid. Well, it's nonsensical because we know conspiracies happen. We had Watergate. We had Iran-Contra. We had Plangate. We know conspiracies happen. So it's crazy to say any suspicion of conspiracy is got to be ludicrous. It's quite the opposite. You should be carefully discerning what are reasonable suspicions and what are not. The conspiracy theory label lumps everything together, from aliens taking over the planet to who assassinated Kennedy. And you lump them all together and then take the most ludicrous example and equate all other suspicions with that. That's not reasonable. That's unreasonable. Conspiracy theory label is un-American. The Declaration of Independence is a conspiracy theory. I urge you to read it. The first part of the Declaration is about inalienable rights, but then it goes on to list a set of crimes that King George committed or was suspected of committing that were intended together to deprive the colonists of their rights as British citizens. And they said they suspected that King was trying to gain tyranny over them and that gave them the right. Not any of the crimes individually, but what they suspected about his motives. So people who say conspiracy theory is ludicrous forget that America was founded on a conspiracy theory. I've already mentioned the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials. That's Robert Jackson, who was a Supreme Court justice, who was our prosecutor in Nuremberg. When people use the term conspiracy theory, what they're forcing on you, in addition to shutting you up and saying that you're crazy, what they're suggesting is that the official account of these events is solid, strong evidence, and what you've got is speculation and, you know, at the very least, dubious. But in reality, if you look at the official accounts of things like the Kennedy assassination or 9/11, basically they are coincidence theories. They're troubling patterns that on their face look suspicious, and they're dismissed as coincidences. When you talk about 9/11 to somebody or the anthrax letter attacks or the Kennedy assassination, they will tell you that the American government would not commit crimes like this. And furthermore, if they did commit them, they're not competent enough to do it. They couldn't pull it off. And furthermore, if by some fluke they did succeed in doing one of these things, they couldn't keep it quiet. Somebody would talk. So there's this assumption that you couldn't do these things. They're just on its face. I have Daniel Ellsberg's book, Secrets, the cover up there. It's a great book. What he reminds us of is that the Manhattan Project, which involved 100,000 people developing the atomic bomb, was kept secret throughout World War II. Totally secret. Truman, when he became president after FDR died, he did not know about the atomic bomb for a week until they told him. It's kept secret through compartmentalization, the need to know. People are working on it, but they don't know what it is. They're doing this part, they're doing that part, building the casing, you know. So it's quite easy for the government to keep secrets. It does an excellent job of it. It's got a very sophisticated technique for doing it. Ellsberg also points out that people who are privy to these secrets think they are really special, think that they really know what's up. So they don't want to tell anybody. What they do is remain silent. He says they listen to people and they think in their minds, if this person knew what I knew, they wouldn't be saying what they're saying. They consider everybody else really just foolish and out of the loop. And the last problem with the conspiracy theory label is that people who use it attack individuals. They attack individuals who say that John Kennedy was killed by more than one shooter or 9/11 was a controlled demolition of the buildings. They attack individuals, but they never talk about the conspiracy theories of the institutions, of the government itself. The conspiracy theory of Iraq trying to get nuclear weapons. Now, that was a dangerous conspiracy theory. That was a conspiracy theory that cost 100,000 lives and thousands of our soldiers. That was a dangerous conspiracy. Does anybody say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory, you shouldn't say that? No, no. So it's really a terrible term. Yes, sir.
One other thing I'd just throw on the false premise. There's a very important false premise that we have, like, free press in this country that's aggressive and that is, just can't wait to expose these kind of things. And if you just go to them and show them the evidence, they'll run right over to the cameras. And
you're absolutely correct. There's an article by Sunstein, the guy who wrote about Cass Sunstein. His wife is Samantha Power, the new UN person. Oh, God. He said exactly what you said. He said the newspapers, that, you know, it would come out. People would sell it. You know, if you knew there was one of these big conspiracies, you'd go to the media and sell your story. If you look at that article and at the footnotes, you know, what's his evidence for this? And he says, well, we found out about the warrantless wiretaps that the Bush administration was doing. Well, yeah, we found out about them, but it was only 2 years after the 2004 election. They knew about it at the New York Times and held that until after the election, and would never have told us, except one of their reporters, James Ryson, was publishing a book in 2005 that had this in there, that they had done these warrantless wiretaps. So I think that's a very good point, and you're absolutely correct. There's the assumption that the press would talk, and in reality, the press is the big gatekeeper of all this stuff. So why do we use the term conspiracy theory? I mean, if it's so stupid and un-American and nonsensical and befuddling, why do we use it? Well, it turns out that the term was popularized by the Central Intelligence Agency in response to the critics of the Warren Commission. In 1967, the Central Office of the CIA sent a memo to all its stations around the world telling them to contact their media assets and tell them if they come across people criticizing the Warren Commission report to call them conspiracy theorists, say there's no evidence of a conspiracy, say that if there had been a conspiracy, somebody would have talked, the newspapers would have uncovered it. It's all the things we hear today about conspiracy theory, the criticisms of it, were in this memo. In my book, I replicate the memo in the appendix. This was reported in the New York Times in 1976 when the memo was declassified, and mistakenly declassified. It was in the news one day, and that was it. Well, they also said, they said you should tell people who are labeling people conspiracy theorists, they should say that the conspiracy theorist is under the sway of communist propagandists. So the idea was if you talked about Kennedy being assassinated by one of our people, that it was something the communists were pushing on us. And it was applied to the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, Wallace. When Robert Kennedy was assassinated, the night he was assassinated, the police are radioing. They were chasing people who they thought might have been involved in it. One of them was this woman that wore the polka dot dress. This is our kind of an arcane point. But what's interesting is the police say on the radio, don't chase this person. We don't want another conspiracy theory. So they're already using this term by 1968 and trying to and being concerned about it. This is just a chart showing the number of stories in the New York Times with the term conspiracy theory in it. I don't know what more to say about it, but I did want to mention, does anybody here know about Google Ngram search? N, the letter N, dash Graham, G-R-A-M. They have a program where they've scanned in books, 5 million books, from the year 1500 to 2008, and you can do a word search on terms and see how often it maps it out for you, just like this. And you can put in conspiracy theory, and it'll show you. It's very interesting to work with. One of the things I'm trying to do is develop a forensic science for tracking these memes. Because that's what the government's doing. And we realize that. We know that they, you know, when they devise a war plan, they'll think up some term like, you know, Operation Iraqi Liberation. Oh, no, that was oil. Operation Iraqi Freedom. But we know they do that. But I don't think we realize that they're doing it behind, you know, secretly and inserting these memes into our public discourse. So I'm using the Google Ngram. Yes, sir.
Yeah. What was the very first reference you found in use of the term?
The term conspiracy theory had come up in a book by Charles and Mary Beard in 1913. It was called The Conspiracy Theory of the 14th Amendment, and it was written about in academic. It wasn't popular. You can't find it in the in the newspapers, but you can find it in their scholarly work. And there was a letter to an editor around 1935 complaining about the conspiracy mentality. And there was a story in like 1963 that was before the Kennedy assassination that was about the conspiracy mindset. So you pick up a little thing, but what you don't see is it being used 25, 30 times. Yeah.
And specifically in the New York Times was the first use.
64.
52?
No, it's picking this up. It picks up an earlier year because the data, as far as I can tell, the Google data has some year mistakes in it. If you go back and track the original sources. The main problem we have that has influenced our thinking with the conspiracy theory label is it causes us to look at these events as isolated events. Like, we have conspiracy theories of Kennedy, of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, but we don't have conspiracy theories of assassinations. We don't look at them together. If I say the term, if I say Kennedy assassination, I'm talking about President Kennedy. Nobody ever uses the term Kennedy assassinations, plural. But those were connected conspiracies, obviously. John Kennedy was running for president. His brother was running for president. When does his brother get killed? His brother gets killed on the night he wins the Democratic primary in California. Okay, so there's obvious connections, and yet we don't say Kennedy assassinations. We don't say 9/11 anthrax. The anthrax occurred immediately after 9/11. It shaped the way we saw it. 9/11 was scary, but it was just in New York. The anthrax could have hit anybody, anywhere. It was very frightening. And yet we separate those in our minds. The term conspiracy, if you have multiple conspiracies, that's called organized crime or serial crime. And we should use that term instead of conspiracy. But it causes us to look at events in isolation. Watergate, burglary. 2000 and the 2004 elections, those were almost identical in terms of the sabotage that was done. Making it difficult for minorities to register, putting too few machines in the urban Democratic stronghold so the lines were real long and people would get discouraged and go away. There were computer anomalies. In Florida, the exit polls showed Gore winning by 3 percentage points. And when the voting returns came back, it was Bush and 500 votes more. Same in Ohio. The exit polls showed Kerry winning by 2 or 3 points. And then when they count the votes, well, that should tell you something. I call it incident-specific myopia. And I point out to people that this is the opposite of the way we view ordinary crimes. If a husband marries a man marries a wealthy woman and she falls in the shower and is killed and he inherits a bunch of money, we're automatically suspicious because it's an improbable event and he benefited. If he then marries another wealthy woman and she falls and hurts or gets killed in a similar accident, we're convinced that this is a plot. I mean, our minds are automatically suspicious. What happened, what they've done, and this is the way these memes work, they're normal, rational processes. When you see things occur, you tend to look at a pattern and you suspect things. And what the conspiracy theory meme is doing is breaking down that rational process. You're not supposed to think about connected crimes. You're not supposed to suspect these people. And so you look at them one by one and you miss the connections between them. Opposite of the way ordinary people... this is a Cass Sunstein article. I may have mentioned it. He is advocating that people who are in conspiracy theory groups online, me and my friends, I guess is who he's talking about, that they should be cognitively disrupted. What I think he means is that they're planting trolls, they're sometimes called, people to get on these online conversations and introduce arguments and ideas that are disruptive and make it very difficult for people to coalesce and strategize constructively about that. I mean, it is breathtaking hypocrisy, what he's proposing. And this is a guy who was head of information, the Office of Information in the Obama administration until recently. What he's saying is we're going to conspire to stop people from saying the government conspires. It's unbelievable. I mean, these people are twisted, deeply twisted. Yeah, I call it linguistic thought control. I think we have to have a name for this stuff, subliminal indoctrination. Sounds kind of paranoid, but if they're doublespeak, yes. Yeah, I went back and read 1984, and he has an appendix in that book that talks about the language and how they were, he thought that they were taking out the emotions out of language and using all these acronyms that shaped your thinking and left you unable to connect your own life to what was going on. I just have a list of 18, 20 SCADs. We've talked about most of these. I include McCarthyism, Oswald, 68, Thomas Price, Ellsberg. The attempted assassination of George Wallace. Wallace was running as a third-party candidate. He had the potential to draw away votes from Nixon. Ross Perot, when he ran, he got 20% of the votes nationally, but he took those votes from Bush, and Bush lost to Clinton. So this was a real fear. Wallace said that Nixon was behind it. He went to the FBI and complained about it. He said, how could this guy be stalking me? Where did he get the weapon? He was staying in expensive hotels. How did he know my schedule? You know, it just doesn't make sense. Somebody had to be helping him. Watergate, we've discussed. The attempt on Reagan is a little less clear, but I'll show you some stuff that might surprise you.
Why do you suppose they go for Reagan?
Well, Reagan got a shot 3 months after he was in office. And the person who shot him, this guy Hinckley, Bush was asked about Hinckley. Did he know him? Had he ever heard of him? He said, no, I don't know anything about these people. I've never heard of him. I have no connection to him. Well, it turns out the Hinckley family had been donating money to his campaigns, lots of money, big money. And then it turned out that the brother, one of the Bush sons,
Neil,
was having dinner with Hinckley's brother the night after the assassination. And you see connections like that, and it's very troubling. It's very troubling. So I include this as a low probability, but I would still consider it. Wellstone I have in here. He was killed in a plane crash when the Senate was evenly divided and debating about going to war in Iraq. I tell my students, do not fly on airplanes with U.S. senators when the Senate is evenly divided. Okay? It's a big risk. There's practical implications to my theories and research. Iraq, 2004. The bogus terror alerts were when they would raise the thing from yellow to orange. Every time Bush's support would go down, there'd be a terror alert. And that's a manipulation. If you just look at the confirmation, most of these are well confirmed. Maybe not officially, but many officially. A few are not so well confirmed, but still are awfully suspicious, including 9/11. And then the low confirmation are the ones that we just haven't gotten confessions, we haven't gotten people talking, we haven't gotten, you know, forensic evidence, medical evidence, and that kind of thing. This was the article in the Houston Post on Reagan, on Bush's son dining with the suspect's brother. I tracked this down through our interlibrary loan. People who do these kinds of crimes, most of them are lawyers. They know the law. They know it very carefully, and they know what they can do with evidence and so on. They've sworn these secrecy oaths. Ellsberg said that the oath that they swear means that even if they're in Congress and they're asked something, they can't say that they know something, that it overrides their sworn oath to Congress. Compartmentalization, conflicts of interest, we know about that. And then, of course, if worse comes to worse, when we've finally got them pinned down, they pardon everybody who might testify against them. They tend to cluster around elections. So the 64 election, the 68 election, 72 election, the 80, 2000, 2004. So when you have a presidential election, be on the lookout for these things. If you look at what are the most common modus operandi, I'm trying to use this criminological lingo because I find it helpful. The most common is assassinations, and I'm counting these as six, and Leahy and Daschle, the Senate leaders who received the anthrax letters, I don't include in this six, so it would be eight if you included that. So that's a very common one. And it's an old historic political crime. You got somebody that you're competing with, kill them. Manipulation of foreign events just to stir up fear and warmongering is almost as common as assassination. And that's another one that is the language speaks to us about false flag operations and provocations, agents provocateur, that kind of thing. Provocations, the election tampering, and then the burglary. The black bag job is something that they do, but they do, it's more likely they do that to us as opposed to a very high leader. But the most common ones use the skills and tactics of the military and intelligence. It's a signature, in effect. If you look at the confirmation in terms, so these are the high confirmation, the medium, and the low. And if you look at what they are, the things that we don't learn about are assassinations. They're very hard. People don't confess to murder. It's really hard to get that out. They will confess to the, you know, McNamara confessed that they knew the Gulf of Tonkin was bogus. He said this on a film. So they'll confess to things like that, but they won't confess to treason and assassination. It's hard to get that information out. And I think that that's the attitude we should have. When we see an assassination, we should realize it's going to be very hard for us to uncover this. We should be very skeptical about what the government says, and we should be insisting on a thorough investigation. Most of the time, these are done for the benefit of military activities, either start a war, prolong a war, create fear of a war. And there are some that are just political opportunism. You know, Nixon was a murderer, and Johnson was. This has come out recently that he had a hired killer that worked for him in Texas. And when you're running against people like that, you know, you likely, think about it. Basically, everybody that ran against Nixon got killed. Okay? John Kennedy beat Nixon in 1960. He gets assassinated in 63. Robert Kennedy is running against him in 1968. And would have won if he lived. He gets whacked. And George Wallace is running against him in 72, and he gets killed or crippled. You know, if you saw that in an ordinary crime, you know, you'd be saying, well, this is obvious. We should be talking to Nixon. Let's find out where this guy was. What do his friends say? Let's talk to his underlings. Let's promise them if they'll confess that we'll give them a good deal. Any ordinary guy, that's what would happen to him. President of the United States, forget it.
It's not illegal if the president does it.
Yeah, that's what their attitude is. That's what Nixon said. If you look at the assassination targets, it's only presidents. It's not vice presidents. It's not U.S. Supreme Court, and senators and presidents. It's not the Supreme Court. I don't want to put any thoughts in anybody's head. But the Supreme Court justices, they don't have protection. They go jogging down in Washington. They have enormous power. People say, well, people don't know who they were. Let me tell you, when I was growing up, there were signs all over the South that said, impeach Earl Warren. Literally. People knew who Earl Warren was in the South. No House member since Gabrielle or until Gabrielle, and there's no evidence to suggest that that was any kind of scan. But, you know, there are a lot of House members. I was in Washington about 6 months ago, was walking around Congress, and Ron Paul came walking by. And I saw her. I said, boy, I just really, you inspire me. I think it's great, the things you do. But I thought, and he said thanks and walked on, and I thought, hell, I could have killed him right there. I mean, I wouldn't have done it. I don't want you to get that. But, because I like him, at least. But, I mean, the point was, he had no protection. He was just out in the open, and there were no gun screens or anything. There's nothing to prevent people from being around him with weapons. So it's bizarre that it's the president that gets targeted. The one thing about the presidents, they only get shot when you've got a very different vice president who, like Johnson, was a real hawk when Kennedy was a dove. George H.W. Bush was a CIA-connected guy when Reagan was more of an isolationist in some ways. And I think the Bushes figured this out, actually, when George H.W. Bush appointed Dan Quayle as his VP, sort of assassination insurance. And George W. Bush appointed Cheney. I mean, you know, are you really going to kill him and get Cheney for president? Nixon actually said when Ford got appointed vice president, he said, uh-oh, I am really worried now. I wasn't worried before when had Agnew, because they weren't going to impeach me and have Agnew president. But now Ford is vice president, I'm in trouble. So they think about this. They're increasing, and they tend to occur around particular administrations. The Bush people are really very suspect. I think we should be very, very cautious about them. There have been a lot of crimes committed while members of their family were in office. And Jeb Bush may run, so. Yes, sir.
You mentioned the King assassination earlier.
Yes.
Of course, William Pepper has done.
It's an excellent book, yes. Yes.
And he's now investigating Robert Kennedy.
Yes. And Kennedy, Robert Kennedy Jr., came out about 6 months ago and said that he thought it was a conspiracy and that Douglas's book, The Unspeakable, was a good account of it. The Kennedys have never spoken about this. And, you know, you people say, well, why? I mean, why would they not speak out? For one thing, they're afraid of getting killed, which is a reasonable fear. But the other thing is there's the elites. This is like the worst taboo. If you speak ill of a fellow elite, it's just a terrible thing. So I think they think of protecting their class interest as more important.
The thing to remember is that this doesn't just happen in this country. One example in Mexico in 1994, there was a reformist candidate named Colosio who was murdered by someone within the official party. And
yeah.
it's never been solved. So it happens in other places. But one interesting thing I wanted to question you on is when your articles are rejected by official magazines and publications, why not go to somewhere like Mother Jones, the Progressive, some of the other really good alternative media out there? It was Mother Jones that exposed the Romney comment before the last.
Do you know what? I've tried to publish in the New York Times. I did get this article in the Guardian. But frankly, my perception is that the left will go all the way up to, but they won't step over the line where we talk about crime. I mean, and we can talk about scandal. We can talk about immoral behavior. But when we talk about crime, that these people are murderers, these people are traitors, these people are embezzlers, you know, nah, we can't talk. We can't say that. That's just too much. It's too much because it implies an action in response. If our leaders are murderers, we can't just sit back. You know, if they're unscrupulous, well, that's okay. If you're, you know, having an affair with the intern, well, that's okay.
I would like to hear your interpretation of why Ronald Reagan chose George H.W. Bush as his vice president.
The story is that Rockefeller went to him and said, "You got to do it. This is our guy." They said in the CIA, Bush had been in the CIA, and they said when the campaign posters were put up surreptitiously in the CIA, there'd be a campaign poster for Reagan Bush, but they would always tear it and take Reagan out. And it was just, but look, they named the building after Bush, the CIA headquarters building. They say he protected them during the Church Commission hearings and all that. I mean, if we saw the Soviet Union, the head of the KGB, become the head of the Soviet Union, which is what we saw with Putin, basically comes the head of Russia, I mean, we'd automatically think, well, this guy's connected. This guy's going to be a gangster of sorts. But we haven't said that about our own system. Yes, ma'am.
Do you have much to say about SCAD since 2008?
The Syria is a SCAD, if we go into that. Libya, in a way, is a SCAD. I mean, it was a violation of international law. It subverted the democratic process because Obama got a tortured Office of Legal Counsel memo saying it wasn't an act of war. So he knew what he was doing. He was subverting it. I'm still holding uncertain the Boston Marathon bombing. I was looking for a connection. There was a peculiar thing that did happen, and that was there were ricin letters that were mailed in Alabama or somewhere. And it occurred right with this. And so I got to thinking, well, you know, this is very similar to 9/11, where you have this bombing terrorist attack and then the chemical, biological attack. And I got to thinking, well, maybe it was a booster shot, you know, from the higher ups. They thought, you know, we needed a little jolt. They didn't want to do a full-blown nuclear attack or something like that, dirty nuclear bomb somewhere, really get us freaked. But they felt like they needed to. I know it sounds very paranoid, but that's what I, if you go back and read NSC 68 and you realize that the government doesn't trust you, the government thinks you are a liability in their effort to maintain your freedom, your viability. Once you realize that, you have to understand they see this as a responsibility to take care of us, and that may mean sacrificing us at times. Yes.
Behind all of this, these cats, appears to be a huge profit motive. And don't we see the banks?
Yes.
Who make their highest profit by far funding war and defense contractors.
Yes.
And these are the people at the apex of these crimes. And
they yes.
make a huge amount of money
yes.
by keeping war.
Yeah, it's a war machine, and it's a financial machine. I have a friend in Australia that writes about economic scads, or he calls them economic scads. They're state crimes that are anti-democratic, but their motive is profit. And there's some specific instances he has in Australia where the government is literally creating projects to fund these nefarious organizations. And they know it's you know, waste of money. So anyway, yes, it's an economic component. What I try to stay on the crimes and get the empirical evidence and then abstract away from that to consider what's the nature of the criminal. And what I'm seeing is all the crimes, or very many of them, are related to war and militarism, and certainly they benefit the armaments companies. And to some extent, the banks as well. But part of what I'm trying to do is create a foundation of work and forensic methods. I think of it as SCAD detectives. We're like Sherlock Holmes for the 21st century. And we're trying to figure out, how do we investigate these people? When I look at science, the way it progresses, it uses observation methods. So the telescope was a huge advance for us. We saw moons circling around other planets. The microscope leads us to germ theory eventually. The thermometer, temperature, we learned that everybody has the same temperature. They used to think everybody had a different temperature. And so what I've been thinking about is, well, we need observation methods for SCAD detection, for state crime detection. And for example, after every election, we should have an audit of the ballots against the exit polls. If we can't do that, we should at least have the statisticians look at it. They've got techniques now where they can tell when the numbers are made up. There are certain patterns to look for. But that should, and if the government won't do it for us, we're going to have to do it for ourselves. And that's pretty much what's been happening. After 2004, Steve Freeman, a statistician at the University of Pennsylvania, looked at all the exit polls and the election returns and compared them and found that 10 out of 11 battleground states had statistically improbable deviations of the returns from the exit polls, and they always favored Bush. And he said he calculated the probability of that given the difference between the exit poll and the returns and the sample sizes. And he said the odds of that happening by chance were like a zillion to one. But we need methods like that. And his paper was published on the internet, and a lot of people followed it. It led to a lot of activity in Florida about elections. But, you know, we need to institutionalize this stuff. Yes, sir, hear you.
Well, we privatized the election counters and contracted it out.
It's unbelievable.
The software is private property?
Yes, it's unbelievable. And why we would put our elections in the hands of people that even if they're angels, why we would do that, it just makes no sense. I was when the Orange Revolution occurred in the Ukraine, one of their candidates who eventually wins the presidency, was poisoned with something that made his face real bad. I don't know if you remember that. And they were interviewing his campaign manager right before the election, and they said, well, you know, do you have any worries about the election? He says, yeah, I'm worried about keeping my guy alive. And, you know, they said, well, really? He said, well, yeah, think about it. We're talking billions of dollars in government contracts and policy affecting, you know, all kinds of things. You think the stakes are not enormously high? People wouldn't do something like that? Well, think about the United States elections. Huge financial implications, huge ideological implications. And then we're going to set it up where we have voting machines with no paper trail that are vulnerable to hacking, and that you can actually plant programs in the machines that switch votes between candidates and then erase themselves at the end of the day. I think I need to go back and look at Vince. What was the guy's name? He shot himself twice in the head.
Foster.
Vince Foster. Went to a park and shot himself twice in the head. That's interesting. What I say in the book, actually, is that I think Republicans are more likely to commit these kinds of crimes than Democrats, and that it has to do with the class base of their party, that they are the upper crust, and the people who are wealthy think the laws don't apply to them, whereas the working people, yeah, the working people, they just obey the laws. Yep.
I was very interested in the fact that assassination seems to be most popular.
Yes.
State crime against democracy. It's ostensibly the CIA can now kill people by
drones, cancer, yes.
By giving them cancer,
yeah.
Or heart attacks. So our methods of forensic investigation are going to be a little bit more
difficult. Well, one thing that I've been looking at is the migration of CIA skills from overseas to the United States. What we see is we have a series of assassinations in the 1950s, and then we get a series in the U.S., the assassinations overseas, then they occur in the U.S. We learn to overthrow elections, and then we see election returns that are peculiar. So part of, you know... But it's these guys, I mean, we cannot underestimate their capabilities. I know that people would accuse me of being paranoid and freaked out, but these are scientists. These are dedicated professionals who are dedicated to influencing us.
They have big budgets.
And they have big budgets. And they're compartmentalized. And what the compartmentalization allows you to do is take control of it, and the people continue to do their compartmentalized work and don't realize that the operation has been steered to another thing. When John Kennedy was killed, Robert Kennedy's first reaction was that they had taken the Bay of Pigs people and diverted them to Kennedy, to his brother. Yes.
I'd like to bring out something, too, which is I've noticed something with particularly people on the left that follow Noam Chomsky, whom I respect a great deal of the work of Noam Chomsky, but I think when it comes to conspiracy stuff, he's very vitriolic and calls people a cult. How dare you even suggest that? And there's a presentation of it particularly about 9/11, which falls into the work that Noam Chomsky and others have been doing, which is saying, hey, we're doing all these horrible things in the Middle East, and then all of a sudden, hey, look, okay, this is blowback, this is what we get. And it kind of fit into this narrative, which is, you know, I thought it was blowback too for probably the first year after it happened. But I've noticed that there are some individuals on the left, particularly followers of Chomsky, who feel threatened by and feel that this is actually undermining, and they feel threatened by conspiracy.
Yes.
And feel that it undermines the real work that's going on and needs to happen. Of course, I have a very radically different perspective than that, which I think just kind of gets at the heart of what's going on. But you want to make it...
Chomsky's a classic case. Chris Hedges is the same way. He's very good. He writes inspiring things, but when it comes down to crime, he just won't go there. And my suspicion is that the reason these people will not go there is they're afraid they'll be discredited. The conspiracy theory term and the norms associated with it are so powerful that if they touch it, they're going to be burned and tarred with that brush. The thing about it that makes it so powerful is that it's a legal thing. Once you get into talking about criminality, well, then we're talking about law enforcement, we're talking about prosecution, we're talking about execution, We're talking about imprisonment. There's an apparatus that swings into motion if you designate something a crime. So I think it's great to talk intellectually about blowback and inequality and that kind of thing, but unless you get it down to these people are not just carrying out a class interest, they're committing crimes. Until we get to that, it's going to be hard for us to stop them. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to mention informationally that one of the early questioners who I didn't turn around to see mentioned Bernays.
Yes.
And there was only one copy of his book circulating here in Colorado, but his books are actually in print.
Yeah.
Propaganda.
Yes.
Opinion. They're in print. You can buy them, and he is a master propagandist, because I remember one of his famous phrases was about something to the effect, the necessary manipulation of the mass public mind.
Yes.
And so he's well worth reading.
Yeah, he was involved in the World War One effort, and a lot of guys came out of that. Harold Laswell Lipton. Yeah. So there's a great book in sociology called The Science of Coercion by I forget the guy's name, but it goes through the history of psychological warfare and says that in sociology that's what it was. They called it something else, but it was really murder and assassination and all that, and they legitimated it, but that's what they were studying, how to manipulate populations. There's a famous book called by Charles Beard, The Economic Interpretation of the Constitution, where he says if you read the Constitution, it protects the class interests of the people who wrote it. And the other thing you might find interesting, Charles Beard developed what came to be called the conspiracy theory of the 14th Amendment. This is the amendment that gives the rights of citizens to corporations. And what Beard said was that the terminology persons was put into the 14th Amendment specifically to have it interpreted by the courts so that they would give these rights to corporations. It was a conspiracy. It involved the railroad lobbyists and the members of Congress who drafted it. A case comes to the Supreme Court in like the mid-1890s. And it was about whether corporations got these rights or not. And a former congressman and a lobbyist for the railroad testified in Congress that, yes, we conspired, we put that language in there, that was our purpose. And the Supreme Court said, you'd think they'd say, you scoundrels, get out of my court. And they said, oh, that was the intent. Okay, that's fine, that's what we'll conclude. So what we're dealing with is with corporations, with Citizens United and stuff like that, goes back to this kind of criminality.
So what's your opinion of what is happening in Colorado, where communities are actually going through the law to bring back democracy?
I think it's great.
There are ballot initiatives in five communities.
Yep.
But of course, our governor is fighting that along with the corporations.
I'm hopeful that we're going to see something like the progressive movement of the early 1900s. That there's some research recently that said that in the early 1900s, before you had the regulatory apparatus established and a lot of the controls in place, people tried to fight these big interests and they had great difficulty with it. They, the unions were broken up by hired thugs and. But they learned, and they developed a consciousness about what was required. And it was the professionalization of government. It was getting rid of elected public officials down through the ranks and the spoil system and all that. So I think part of what's happening with things like fracking and fighting that and working through the local institutions is that you're experimenting and learning what's working, but you're creating the foundations for a much larger movement across a range of issues. Because what we've got with the corporations and finance is just, how can you have a democracy when you've got this kind of concentration of wealth? The capture of the regulatory agencies. I think we should take seriously the oaths of office. And that oath is not just that you're going to obey the law, but you're going to protect, defend, and preserve the Constitution. And that Constitution is designed to empower us as a people. The preamble says we have come together to create this government so that we preserve our security and our rights and our freedoms. And when people swear to it, they're swearing to a broad oath. I mentioned, I think tonight, that when Andrew Johnson was impeached, he was impeached for insulting the Congress, was one of the things. But I mean, if you go back and read the impeachments, it wasn't like smoking guns. It was like, this guy's a scoundrel. You know, this guy is a liar. And that's what we've got to get back to. We don't need smoking guns. If we see that people are not protecting our interest, they are committing crimes. They're there to protect our interest. And, you know, I jokingly say, but there's some seriousness, that we should erect a guillotine down in Wall Street, a statue, but a guillotine, and just to remind people, this is what happens when you don't respond to the public over time. Eventually, they're going to get you.
Last night, you mentioned the use of the Zapruder film of the Kennedy assassination. It was purchased, of course, by Life magazine.
Right.
But the publisher of Life at the time was C.L. Jackson, who in fact was the architect of a CIA operation in psychological warfare called Operation Mockingbird.
Yes.
Began in 1952.
Yep.
And which continued not only through the period of the Kennedy's assassination, but at least up until 1975.
Yes, this is pervasive. There was a National Security Council memo called NSC 68. You can find it on the internet. It was published in 1950. And what it said is the American people don't have the stomach, basically, to stand up toe-to-toe against the Soviet Union in a nuclear standoff, and it was going to take some effort on the part of the leadership to make us realize the importance of doing this. But it was basically a plan to manipulate the mass public, and I think, certainly it included Mockingbird, the infiltration of the civil rights, anti-war, and women's movement. I'm pretty paranoid at this point. I mean, I wrote an article for The Guardian about 3 weeks ago when they closed the embassies down because of they said there was chatter in the electronic communication and there were going to be these attacks. And I wrote this editorial and said, hey, we've seen this before. They do these terror alerts whenever they're in trouble and everybody's criticizing the electronic surveillance, and suddenly the electronic surveillance is saving us from these attacks. It's ridiculous. But it's a pervasive thing. There's a psychoanalyst, a French psychoanalyst named Lacan, who talks about the authoritative, the regime of order, of conceptual order, what's our framework. And I think that's what happens is you plant a few key concepts and events. You know, Gulf of Tonkin attack, 9/11, and everything else gets framed around that, everything downstream. So you can have a democratic process downstream, and you think you're influencing Congress, but they've already set the agenda for you with these state crimes. Okay, let me get back to it, because I get this a lot. People ask me when I go over this, well, what can we do? Well, if everybody's they're running the country like this and staging and orchestrating these events that shape our society and our politics, what can we do? My answer, one simple answer, is enforce the law. Enforce the law. We have pretty good laws on the books about conspiracy and fraud. When the Bush administration said that they didn't want to see the smoking gun be a mushroom cloud and that they were sure that yellow cake had been bought at Niger and all that. Well, they had other information that they didn't tell us. They had other information. The Germans had said they didn't trust the intelligence. The people in Niger said, no, this hadn't happened. But they didn't tell us that. They didn't come to us and say, well, we have very confusing intelligence, but we're thinking about launching a war. They said, we have very clear intelligence. That was an act of fraud. And experienced prosecutors have said that George Bush should be prosecuted for murder that he got these soldiers killed under false pretenses. It's a simple thing of controlling the crime scene after an assassination. We had heard things in 2001, 2002, 2003 about surveillance, but nobody paid much attention to it until we had documents. This is what Ellsberg says in Secrets. He says, you can tell people about it. You can be an insider and say, I heard this, but people will blow you off. But if you have the documents, another thing I think that we need to do is be careful with our language. And that's why I'm looking at conspiracy theory and saying, that is a bad term. That is a bad term. I think that 9/11 is not a good term. I don't mean to say, I'm not sure what we would call it, but by defining it as a date, it elevates the importance of the event, and we need to ask ourselves, where did that term come from? We've never called these events by dates. We didn't call Pearl Harbor 12/7. We didn't call Kennedy 11/22. Why did we call this? Anyway, here I'm going on.
What do you think of the Boston Marathon bomb?
There are a lot of suspicions about it, a lot of questions, and a lot of peculiar coincidences. I'm not compelled by the idea that it was a conspiracy, but I wouldn't rule it out. But here's what I asked myself when I saw it. Were there any other crimes committed around it during the same time? Because when you go back and look at state crimes against democracy, the way I'm defining it, what you see is they occur in clusters. So you have Watergate, you have Ellsberg being stalked, you have the 1968 October surprise. When you see these, what happens is, I think, when these criminal elements get into government and start acting, they don't stop with one crime. When they killed Kennedy, they didn't stop with Kennedy. They killed Oswald. Yes, sir, in the back.
You know. You said what we need to do is enforce the law. That's a great point. So how do you propose to do that?
One thing I'm trying to do is devise forensic techniques that allow us to come forward with something beyond speculation. I have written about it, about let's get laws passed that mandate. One thing I think we should have is if there's an assassination, we should mandate the crime scene is controlled, all the witnesses are interviewed, and those are made public. That's the problem. No. Yeah, I have read about that. There's a guy in Florida that's talking about it. That's right. And that's an important point, too, is to try to find venues that are legal processes. So it's not us just arm-waving, that we can actually get some action, some legal action. A woman who ran for attorney general didn't win in, it was a northeastern state. Anybody know what I'm talking about? She ran with the idea of prosecuting Bush for murder. And she got Bugliosi, the lawyer who prosecuted the Manson for his murder, has written a lot, and she had him as an advisor. But that was their argument, is we need to get this into judicial process.
Have you heard about a movement to have only 3% of Americans pull all their money out of banks?
Oh, God.
Do you think that would be effective?
Well, it would certainly cause a lot of economic damage, and I don't know. I look at Occupy Wall Street as a good example these days of a mass movement. It didn't have a lot of effect on the doing a business in the United States, but it changed the discourse. People now talk about one percenters, and when Romney was running for president, there was that tape where he came out with the 47% who get all this stuff. You know, it really affected the discourse. So my strategy is to affect the discourse. That I think that's something we can do. Buy my book. Write reviews on Amazon. Tell people that use the term state crimes, elite political criminality. Don't let people use the term conspiracy theory. Say, wait a minute, that's a flawed term. We know that came from the CIA. We got no business using this. As it stands, it's the other way around. If you're on TV and you say something like, that's a conspiracy theory, everybody goes, yeah, we shouldn't talk about that. So I think that, I don't mean to say that that's, you know, it's not getting us into grand juries, it's not getting us into court. When I was in Toronto in 2011 for their 10-year hearings. There was a judge there from Italy who was on the Supreme Court of Italy. And that's what he said, you've got to get this into a court of law. He recommended that we go to the United Nations has an international criminal court. They can do investigations, and we could investigate the United States, even if the United States said they didn't want to be investigated. And we can't necessarily try anybody, but we can at least investigate and embarrass the heck out of the leadership and change people's thinking about it. So I agree. I think we need to be looking at judicial processes, but also the language, also speaking up. American democracy is in real, real trouble if it even exists anymore.
When you say democracy, are you referring to Republican democracy, pure democracy?
I'm referring to the spirit of popular control of government, and not necessarily representative government, although that's the form that we have. I think we have a constitution that is revered and a set of founders that are revered. And let me tell you, these people were conspiracy theorists. These people were vigilant. They were concerned about tyranny. They thought that anybody who had power would abuse it. That's why they created the system of checks and balances, to pit against each other the powers. They had these people swear an oath. Their top priority is not to protect the people. It is to protect, preserve, and defend the Constitution of the United States. They swear an oath to that. When they violate that oath, that's an impeachable offense, even if it's in the spirit. Go back and look at how we've impeached presidents. When we impeached Andrew Johnson, he was impeached for things like insulting the Congress. Today, it's like you've got to find this smoking gun. You know, what did Nixon know and when did he know it? Wait a minute, you don't have to know that. Nixon hired a bunch of criminals. He should be impeached just for that. So I think that the founders are important, and we need to resuscitate that tradition. It gives us a foundation for uniting the right and the left in this country, the Tea Parties and the left, on the rule of law and the Constitution. For one thing, we couldn't go into Syria if we followed the Constitution. I think there's a counterculture forming now because of the mass surveillance that has now been publicized. That it's impossible for the American people not to see themselves as distinct and separate from the government. And the government is not their government anymore. The government is the government. And they are, in a way, the adversary, the enemy, and are being snooped on. And just that state of mind is going to cause what happened in the 60s, the counterculture, where people begin to talk about us and what we think and what we believe and feel, as opposed to what these people in Washington think. The 1% language does that a little bit. But I think, it's not for nothing that somebody like me is writing about state crime. People are waking up. People are beginning to see. They're apathetic, but when it comes to their liberties and their personal freedoms, they take it a little bit more seriously. So I personally think that we're going to see a real revolution of consciousness in this country in the next, maybe. The other thing I would say about looking back at the 60s is that took 10 years. Okay, you had the counterculture movement began in the early 60s on the campuses. You had the anti-war movement really flowing out of the civil rights movement and the women's movement. That all takes about 10 years, and you don't get, you know, the church commission for 15 years. It's a long process. Today we have the internet. Today we have email. Today we have dialogues that occur very quickly on this information. You can go home tonight and look up that dispatch I was telling you about. You have the document. You can say to people, you want to see where conspiracy theory came from, that word? Here, take a look at this. That is light years ahead of where we were in the 60s. So I think that there is a realization coming.
You're talking about moving past left and right and talking about resurrecting constitutional governance and law and order, essentially, I think. But one thing you mentioned when you were talking about the Boston Marathon, that you looked for unusual patterns of what appears to be like illegal activity. And I would add to that also pushing the envelope. For example, in Boston, that was an instance where they instituted martial law.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
So they did these demonstrations. Yeah. And with a company with a lot of press that's very self-congratulatory, how happy everyone was.
Yep.
That they did that. And that sort of thing, I think,
Well, and I think our attitude should be that that should be investigated. All that stuff should be investigated. The Athenians had a process when you got out of office. They went through all of your records to see if you had committed any crimes. And that's what we should do. When you leave office, it should be a thorough inspection of the books and taking depositions from people and so on. These guys would get a lot straighter after that.
And because of the popularity of that movie called Argo, and because of the recent publication, the Christian Science Monitor, of what Bonnie Sager said really happened during the hostage.
Yes.
I'd appreciate it if you could go into that more.
Well, the 1980 October surprise, George Bush was the vice president nominee with Reagan, and he and Bill Gates, who was the Secretary of Defense under Bush, and Bill Casey, this should tell you, William Casey was the campaign manager for the Reagan-Bush campaign, and after they got elected, they made him head of the CIA. Now, you go, campaign manager, CIA, whoa. But same with Bush. I mean, he had been head of the Republican National Party in 1972 when Watergate happened. They make him head of the CIA. Ford puts him in there. But in 1980, Gates, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Casey met with the Iranians and got them to keep the hostages through the election so that Carter would look weak, and it ultimately costed Carter the election. There was an obvious tell in that SCAD, too, and that was they released the hostages on Inaugural Day. I mean, they do this. This is an amazing thing to me. It's obvious. You know, what's the difficulty is pinning these people down and proving it, but you can see it on the surface. They did an investigation of that in Congress, and Casey and Bush came up with alibis, and of course said it was ludicrous to think they had done it and all that. And then later their alibis came into question. There were real doubts about, they appear to have slipped off from meetings that they were supposed to be in. But when Iran-Contra broke, see what they had told the Iranians in 1980 was that if they would hold the hostages, the Reagan-Bush administration would sell arms to Iran, who were fighting a war with Iraq. And we had propped up the Shah in Iran, and so all their military stuff was American. And they didn't have like tires for their airplanes and things like that. And so Reagan and them said, you keep the hostages and then we'll sell you arms. Well, they start selling arms in April. This later comes in April, right after the inauguration. Later, this perambulates into the Iran-Contra scandal, where they're selling arms to Iran, taking the profits and sending them to rebels who are trying to overtake a democratically elected socialist government in Nicaragua. When they investigated Iran-Contra, the Congress stipulated that they would not go back and look at the 1980 issue. So they did all this investigation of Iran-Contra, but, well, we're not going to go back. But these guys, they all protect each other. They pretty much look after themselves. Nixon was pardoned. Understand this. Nixon was pardoned not just for the crimes he committed, but for all crimes he committed or might have committed while president. Yeah, might have committed. Didn't even get a list. We don't even know what they were. You know? So when I say enforce the law, I mean, for one thing, we should have a law that says you can't pardon people who you order to commit a crime. I mean, geez. I mean, at the very least. Yes.
I was going to ask, how do you enforce the law when the people who are in the power and doing these conspiracies and whatever are the ones that are writing the law?
Yeah, no, it's a very big problem. But one thing that I've argued in my writings and in class is that the people near the bottom of the pyramid, they do the right thing. If we have professional programs and encourage people to take an oath and remember when the hijackers were coming into the United States, there was a guy that stopped one of the hijackers and sent him back. When John Kennedy was killed, the Secret Service took his body back to Washington. There was supposed to be an autopsy in Dallas. The coroner in Dallas tried to stop them, you know, stood in front of the coffin and said, no, I'm not going to, and they moved him aside by force. But at the front line, we've got strong people. I mean, just regular old Americans, you know, they'll speak up. I think having juries instead of these Warren commissions, you know, I mean, you put all of these muckety-mucks on a commission and they're all going to take care of each other because they're thinking about, you know, I don't want to piss this guy off. You know, what am I going to get business from? And are they going to appoint me to something later? Just give me an American jury and let them judge this stuff. So, but part of it is we have to restore our skepticism about our leaders. I mean, the founders thought they were dangerous people.
And thank you to Olivier for pointing me in the direction of that talk. Now, we conclude with part one of a radio adaptation of the best film, I think, that can ever be made about Operation Gladio, because it interviews a lot of the key players, heads of the parliamentary inquiries into Gladio, government officials, members of Gladio, some of them convicted, serving long sentences, and a lot of these people are now deceased. It was something of a breakthrough at the time, which really put Gladio on the map. May, of course, have put Alan Frankovich on the map as far as deep state forces were concerned. Alan Frankovich, you may recall, died ostensibly natural causes of a heart attack after being taken aside for questioning by officials while going through customs at an international airport in the US. Might just be coincidence, perhaps it's my statistical training, but there might be more to it than that. Anyway, I present a radio adaptation of Alan Frankovich's 1992 production, which was broadcast once on BBC Two. I don't think it's ever been repeated, but the video is available for download, and I shall link again from this episode's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/724.
Deception is a state of mind, and the mind of the state.
James Jesus Angleton, deep politician, head of CIA counterintelligence, 1954 to 1974. Michel van Usset, Belgian Gladio, 1987 to 1991.
One day, a man came to my house and asked me if I would accept a confidential mission. He told me it was something within the framework of NATO. He didn't explain much. It was advisable not to be too specific, because this was one of the most secret organizations that has ever existed. We had a radio at our disposal. Our base was near London, with the second base near Boston.
Une radio à notre disposition, et la base était effectivement située dans les environs de Londres, et une deuxième base se trouvait du côté de Boston.
Decimo Gallo, trainer, Capo Malaggio, Gladio Base.
Ho fatto esercitazioni con reparti speciali.
I work with special American, English, French, and Belgian units. Normally, these exercises involved dropping special forces who came directly from France, Belgium, and England. They were parachuted in, and the men we had trained guided them down to the ground and then helped them to get to safe houses.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra, former member of a neo-fascist group Ordine Nuovo, speaking from his jail cell.
Gladio, così come è stata definita.
Gladio, as it is defined nowadays, forms part of what I have always referred to as parallel structures. That is, an invisible army that is not poised for battle against a hypothetical invader, but rather one meant to be used internally against what the military have always called the fifth column of the USSR, the Communist Party, and the extreme left.
For 40 years, secret terrorist organizations, many trained by Western intelligence agencies, have manipulated the political control of European sovereign states by a campaign of terror and murder. Originally part of a secret network, these groups changed from being defenders of state security into attackers of the established political order. Until 2 years ago, that secret network was generally known by the single word, Gladio. On November the 9th, 1990, the Prime Minister of Italy, Giulio Andreotti, revealed to his own parliament and the world the existence of a top-secret European-wide network of secret agents. It was called Gladio. This network of stay-behind groups was intended to fight a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. Andreotti's announcement led to an immediate reaction in the capitals of Europe. The suspicion was that some parts of the Gladio structures were involved in internal subversion.
Senator Roger Lallemand, head of the Belgian parliamentary inquiry into Gladio.
The Belgian stay-behind network was brought to our attention by what they call Gladio, the scandal unleashed after the revelation of the stay-behinds in Italy. Our Minister of Defense was called by his Italian colleague, who wanted to know what decisions had been taken at the last meeting of the European Stay Behind.
Guy Coem, Belgian Defence Minister, 1988-1991.
In November 1990, an Italian delegation came to ask me if I knew what Gladio was. I didn't know anything, except that on that very day, I read about it in an Italian newspaper on a flight to Brussels. In this way, I learned of the scandal in Italy called Gladio.
Senator Roger Lallemand.
The minister let this amazing detail be known, that he didn't know that a stay-behind existed in the Belgian army and state security. Gladio has always been protected. This is one clear example.
Senator Libero Gualtieri, head of the Italian parliamentary inquiry into Gladio.
Moro was called to testify. They asked if he knew of a parallel secret structure inside of the services. And Moro asked the services what sort of answer he should give. They told him it didn't exist. And so Moro said, I've been told that this doesn't exist.
Carlo Schmidt, head of the Swiss parliamentary inquiry into Gladio. Part of the Swiss authorities knew of the existence of this structure. Some MPs in a secret council had some control, but it was ineffective because these MPs knew virtually nothing. Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
These parallel structures use the extreme right for the simple reason that they fought the communists. In 1945, the Second World War ended and the Third World War started.
The autumn of 1944. Benito Mussolini would be dead in 6 months. Adolf Hitler in less than a year. As the Allied armies advanced on the capitals of Axis-occupied Europe, the other war, the secret war of agents and partisan groups that had always been part of the bigger war, was to reach its own climax.
Alla mattina, appena alzata, oh bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao.
As the Germans withdrew, they left secret agents in the countries they had occupied. The secret services call such groups stay-behinds. For the retreating Germans, they were the staunchest believers. They were selected from the SS and the fascist Black Legions. They were to become the foot soldiers of the next war about to begin, the Cold War.
Le Palais des Sports de Bruxelles a été le théâtre d'une manifestation.
In Brussels, a massive meeting has been staged on the theme Peoples of Europe against Bolshevism. We saw over there on the Russian plains the Italians and Croats, the Hungarians, Norwegians, the Danes, our Flemish brothers. We all met over there, these great forces which rose up. Why? Because they too had this vision of the truth. Let us do battle together.
Ahead of the advancing Allies, always with the first troops, was the OSS, Office of Strategic Services. And that part of the OSS charged with locating enemy stay-behinds had been given the designation X2.
Peter Tompkins, OSS Office, Rome, 1943-45.
I came in and sent by General Donovan and got in touch with the heads of the Committee of National, the military junta of the Committee of National, which is the joint partisan groups. Andy Birding was the first X2 guy who came into Rome. And he'd been an old AP correspondent, and I thought I could trust him, that he was a good guy. And so we turned over to him everything we had on the German stay-behinds. Then Jim Angleton appeared in August. He began recruiting fascists because he figured that the best way to control the communists was to hire fascists. One of the most tough ones was Prince Valerio Borghese, who ran what was known as the 10th Flotilla. These are the guys that would execute partisans and hang them from lampposts all over Italy.
Oh, bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, 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 oh, mamma mia. Oh, che tormento, io ti invoco ogni domani.
Angleton made a deal with Borghese and then rushed up to save this commander from the partisans who would have lynched him any time because he had lynched thousands of partisans.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra.
Prince Valerio Borghese takes us right to the heart of the American Secret Services. He was saved and protected by Angleton in 1945 when he gave himself up in Milan at the end of the Second World War in Italy. The Decemamas, the group that Valerio Borghese commanded, promised the Allies to take up arms in the event of a Soviet invasion.
Licio Gelli, later to head the secret P2 Masonic Lodge, had been a liaison officer attached to the SS. He had his own encounter with X2 agents.
Licio Gelli, Venerable Master of the P2 Masonic Lodge.
We were taken prisoners by a group of Canadians who handed us over to the ISS. I was treated well by them for about a week. In an apartment in Pistonia, they brought me a sheaf of paper, and the officer told me to write down my life story from my first communion to the present. A week later, they asked if I wanted to be parachuted into the north. It was a U.S. colonel who asked, but I said no, my work was over.
To show what a cynical game it is, this young policeman, Federico Umberto D'Amato, the night that the Allies came in to Rome, rounded up all the German stay-behinds, whose addresses he had, put them in jail, turned them over to the Americans, and they were disposed of.
The German stay-behinds were turned over to Italian authorities and sentenced by Italian military courts.
Federico Umberto D'Amato, head of the political police, Ministry of the Interior, 1972-74.
I was working at the hotel when General Meltzer was placed. He was the head of German armed forces in Roma. The Central Command of the Abu Wel Lufta was also there. One day I managed to get into one of the rooms with some risk. I got hold of these lists of names. When the Germans left, contrary to my expectations, these people remained, because there was an operation to leave people in place once they were retreating, so they wouldn't have to cross the lines. Something like, you know this better than I do. Operation Gladio. When the Americans came for these men, they were already in custody.
From that day of his joining Jim Angleton, or the X2 part of OSS, he ran the secret police for the next 40 years.
It was from that moment that I started working with him, always in agreements with my government and the authorities. Many police officers were forced to follow Mussolini north. They were in a sorry state at that time. Since my father was a police official and knew everyone, the X2 branch decided to parachute me, a complete novice, into the region of Saulo. I luckily managed to arrive safely, where I met the main officials of the Republic of Saulo. They naturally agreed to cooperate. After the war, they became important leaders of the Italian state, the police forces, and the Ministry of Interior.
Now, the next character, who doesn't show his face, is introduced as Colonel Oswald Le Winter from the CIA ITAC Liaison Officer Europe, where ITAC is the Intelligence Tactical Assessment Center of the DIA. Liaison was assigned to a CIA officer. I'm going to give you a little bit of background to him. His official narrative, Wikipedia, as of August this year, presents him as a convincing storyteller, best known for his stories about the October Surprise controversy. Wikipedia still not accepting that the October Surprise conspiracy actually happened. That's another story, but Wikipedia is highlighting the claim that he's a chameleon who can show up and pretend to be anyone, anywhere. That, to me, falls a bit short of the facts, because things like his arrest in 1971 with an NYPD badge and diplomatic papers, including claims that he was a Knight of Malta, British authorities jailed him but decided not to pursue charges. In 1984, he was arrested for a $100 million scheme to smuggle methamphetamine into the US, including manufacturing it, sentenced to 6 years, but released after two. So this and a few other things as well, the October Surprise conspiracy, Lockerbie, he seems to be involved in quite a lot of information. Now, perhaps he is just an amazingly high-flying con man, in which case it seems odd that the authorities have pursued a light touch with him. I don't know what the going rate for methamphetamine production and smuggling is, but I would have thought 2 years for $100 million worth is pretty light. His statements have contradicted one another, and he has on occasion said, yes, I was lying before, now it's the truth. So we have to bear that in mind. That seems to me to be, possibly he's a pathological liar. A lot more likely, though, given the various intrigues in which he does appear to me to have been involved, he's made a comment and people have lent on him to retract that comment. So he's been persuaded, who knows how, to change his testimony for the purposes of pleasing higher-ups in the power structure. He's also involved in a claim that Diana, Princess of Wales, and Dodi Fayed were unlawfully killed, and he claimed to have evidence of that. And Trowbridge H. Ford has claimed that Le Winter was Duane Claridge's deputy for European operations. Now, whether or not it's true, as one commentator noted, Oswald Le Winter is an article unto himself, one of hundreds feeding mystery meat into the sausage grinder of history, I thought it was worth having a little bit of a biographical detour before we continued with his testimony, since Frankovich makes extensive use of it in this video.
Gladio was a joint brainchild, but its most intense architect was Angleton. And Angleton, as most people know, was a sort of a professional paranoiac. One of his favorite sayings used to be that even paranoiacs have enemies. And Angleton was a fellow who felt that you couldn't trust anybody, particularly not any foreign country.
Federico Umberto D'Amato.
As time passes, as more is discovered about the Second World War and the period after that, namely the Cold War, you will learn what an extraordinary man Angleton was, a truly extraordinary man, even to the point of being slightly crazy. For as Erasmus of Rotterdam said, a little madness is needed in everything. And when you were recruited by the OSS, which was the service that the CIA grew out of, there was a sign saying, to join the OSS, you don't have to be crazy, but it helps. I really think Angleton wrote that.
William Colby, Knight of Malta, attendee of Le Cercle and Director of Central Intelligence from 1973 to 1976.
We sort of anticipated another world war, and a world war that would be characterized by an occupation of Western Europe by Soviet forces. And therefore, we were preparing to set up the base for a resistance movement which could exist during the war.
Now, the next speaker, Ray Klein, is subtitled as Deputy Director of the CIA, 1962 to 1966. In fact, he was Director of the Directorate of Intelligence in the CIA, possibly a small difference. Now, worth noting that he spoke at the 1979 Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism that we looked at in episode 714.
The Soviet Union was viewed as our primary antagonist, our enemy, and I think that was true. The Stalinist period was a really vicious period in the Soviet Union, and we thought in the late 40s and early 50s that Stalin might invade Western Europe.
John Singlaup, U.S. Army Major General, 1972 to 78, and involved in Iran-Contra.
It was the plan that I knew about, that the people who had a logical reason for being in a given area where we felt it was essential to have stay-behinds, and whose activities could continue even after an attack by the Warsaw Pact, he would be given additional training. He would know the location of some of the arms and communications caches, and that he would be able, as a result of his training, to recruit additional personnel to augment his network, and that it would include not only just communications, but it would include the ability to use explosives.
The stay-behind effort, in my view, was simply to be sure that if the worst came to worst, if a Communist Party came into power, that there would be some agents there who would tip us off and tell us what was happening and be around to provide the information even after the coup might occur.
Thomas Polgar, CIA, Germany, 1951.
With the emergence of NATO in Western Europe, in specific response to the communist takeover in Czechoslovakia in 1948 and the Berlin blockade, directives were issued to establish Europe-wide stay-behind organizations along the lines which existed in the final years of World War II in Western Europe.
Oswald LeWinter.
There was an amendment to the NATO protocol, and that amendment was absolutely necessary. You didn't get in the door unless you sign. And what was in that amendment was the agreement of the government not to prosecute right-wing activists, right-wing activities, anti-communist activists in their own countries.
Ray Klines.
It's not unlikely that some right-wing groups were recruited and made to be stay-behinds because they would indeed have tipped us off if a war were going to begin. So using right-wingers, if you use them not politically but for intelligence purposes, is okay.
Erhard Dabringhaus, U.S. Counterintelligence Corps, Germany, 1948-49.
In 1948, I was a special agent with CIC, that's our counterintelligence corps in occupied Germany. I was stationed in Augsburg, and as such, since I spoke fluent German, I was assigned to handle a network of German informants. Among them was Klaus Barbie. And Klaus Barbie was later on, I discovered that he was wanted for murder by the French, and that I reported this to my superiors, and they told me to keep nice and quiet. He's still valuable. When he's no longer valuable, we'll turn him over to the French. I thought that I was going to get a promotion when I told them about Barbie, and they told me to keep quiet. Colonel Gunther Bernau was an agent, an informant, working for the military intelligence in Stuttgart. We had provided him a home, a safe house in Ludwigsburg, and there I met him three times a week, and he brought us information about communists and whatever we wanted to hear, he told us. He was certainly a very strong Nazi. I sat in his office one day and opened his album of pictures from the war, and in the middle of the album it showed a nice picture of Adolf Hitler. Several other high-ranking SS officers who came to visit him in his safe house that we had provided, and he told me that if for any reason he needs help, by one telephone call he could contact 200 former SS leaders from Hamburg to Munich. I remember him taking me to one particular spot, which we uncovered and dug it out, and there were rifles, small arms, grenades, all nicely wrapped in cosmoline, and he said, we have thousands of these all over the country. And that sort of made me a little suspicious, and I reported this, and they said, well, we know this. They're all working for us in case the communists come across the Iron Curtain. A former general, SS general, Paul Hauser, was a frequent visitor at Bernau's house, and they worked together hand in glove about certain programs, which we didn't know anything about, and I wasn't even asked to find out more about it. Somebody above me must have been running this network already at that time.
Oswald LeWinter.
The man in Adenauer's office, who also had, I guess, his fullest confidence, who oversaw Gladiot in its earliest stages, was a fellow named Dr. Glopke, who was an ex-Nazi, who Adenauer had brought into the government the way he'd brought a lot of ex-Nazis into the government, because I guess his position was that these were the only people who really had any administrative experience, and so they were, I guess, denazified, if you want to call it that. They were cleaned up a little bit like today, Nazi, tomorrow, Democrat, like changing undershirts.
What we were doing is either with the government secretly or independently on our own looking for people who might perform this function in some country where you didn't have that connection with the government or whatever, or maybe you did as a supplement. but maybe one or two extra people that would have this training who would stay there during a Soviet occupation and be the base that you could then talk about recruiting other people to join.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it this week due to time. Many thanks to all the volunteers who lent their voices to Alan Frankovich's film. It's not too late. I still need one or two more voices. If you'd like to, you can contact me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net, and offer to help. This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune by Billy Bragg and Wilco has lyrics by Woody Guthrie. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio. TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness. Melting of the Arctic Sea Ice with Cambridge Glaciology Professor Peter Wadhams. Only days before Professor Wadhams set off on his 2015 research voyage to the Arctic, the UK blogger Nick Breeze did an interview with him, asking him about the latest data on the disappearing Arctic sea ice. Peter Wadhams is Professor of Ocean Physics at the University of Cambridge, UK, with over 40 years of research on Arctic sea ice, icebergs, and polar oceanography. He's considered one of the leading experts in his field. This interview is posted on the website envisionation.co.uk. Nick Breeze and Brew Pierce set up the site as a place to present thoughts, ideas, and interviews on the developing crisis of climate change and on our collective and individual response to it. They write that, quote, one major challenge facing our generation right now is the need to transition away from hydrocarbon energy sources, coal, oil, and gas. Failure to achieve this in a short time frame will mean that the planet warms up unstoppably to unprecedented levels in which civilization can no longer function. Never has there been a greater need for global cooperation to solve the biggest crisis that we, as a species, have ever encountered. End quote. The urgency of this matter stands in stark contrast to Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change computer models. They claim that Arctic summer sea ice will not disappear until 2050 or even 2100. Professor Wadhams argues that this is based on serious errors in computer modeling and predicts an ice-free Arctic summer ocean by 2020, with very few remnants of sea ice along some coastal zones and blocking channels in the Northwest Passage. When the interview took place at the end of September 2015, we had just heard on the news that the sea ice minimum at the end of the Arctic summer was the fourth lowest on record. It stands at about half of the ice that used to cover the same area. You will hear in a moment the scientific evidence based on his four decades of research in the Arctic that led Professor Wadhams to that timeline. What is so interesting and worrisome about this interview is that Wadhams delivers a sequence of arguments that make clear that we're not only losing the refrigerator in the Arctic that reflected back into space 80 to 90% of the heat of the sun, but that consequences and feedback mechanisms are already destabilizing the climate of the Northern Hemisphere, way beyond the boundaries of the Arctic. In the interview you heard last week, Wadhams had spoken about the increased methane releases from the shallow oceans and permafrost areas along the continental shelves that were once protected by a layer of snow or sea ice. He says this will dramatically increase the greenhouse gases that are warming the planet. In this interview, he goes into more detail about how the disappearance of the sea ice changes the vortex of the North Pole. The polar vortex is a persistent, large-scale cyclone circling the poles. This cold core, low-pressure area strengthens in the winter and weakens in the summer because of the temperature difference between the equator and the poles. The assumption is now that reduced snow cover and sea ice in the Arctic reflect less sunlight, which in turn alters the pressure and temperature gradient of the polar vortex, causing it to weaken or collapse. And that causes the jet stream, which is the strong air current at the boundary of the polar vortex, to slow down. We are already familiar with the meteorological maps that show that the jet stream develops much bigger meanders, and the meanders do not progress around the planet very fast. That, Wadhams says, explains the persistent anomalous weather patterns at different longitudes around the planet that we are already experiencing, bringing floods, droughts, and unusual cold spells. It is assumed that a recent blocking event occurred when high pressure over Greenland steered Hurricane Sandy into the northern mid-Atlantic states. Here is Nick Breeze beginning the interview with Professor Peter Wadhams by asking about the latest news. My apologies for the low sound quality of this interview done on Skype.
We've just heard in the news that the Arctic sea ice minimum for this year is the fourth lowest on record, with 4.4 million square kilometres of sea ice remaining. Can you put that in the context of how fast the ice has melted away and why we might reach a summer ice-free Arctic ahead of IPCC projections that say somewhere between 2050 and 2100?
Yes, 4.4 million is about half of the area that the ice used to occupy in the summer. It's a bit above the absolute minimum, which happened in 2012, which was 3.4, but the trend is rapidly downwards, and the trend of summer area is still showing a disappearance of the ice in summer by about 2020, or something like, certainly not after 2020, and there's no countervailing force to bring the ice back up again. It's on the way down. So the observations show that we can expect a summer ice-free Arctic by 2020, maybe earlier. What's so bizarre is that the computer models that are used are predicting something like late this century as the time for the summer ice to disappear, which is quite impossible. It's completely impossible that it could last that long. So we have a huge disconnect between the models.
As an Arctic researcher who goes to the Arctic, you're seeing the quality of the ice, and now we're talking about 4.5 million square kilometres. What's the quality of that ice like?
Well, it's really rotted. I mean, I was up there last August, and I'm going up there again next week. And the ice that remained, which of course would show up on the satellite imagery and show us as an area of ice, was very, very thin and completely rotted away, so that a single storm would be enough to clear out huge areas of ice. So we're still, although the trend this year is to be bottoming out at 4.4, there's still time for a single storm to take away another huge area of the ice, because it's so thin and rotted, completely unlike the way it used to be in summer.
When we talk about an ice-free Arctic, how many square kilometres are we talking about? Is it completely gone, or...?
The assumption is that there might be about a million square kilometres left of ice that's up against coastlines, blocking channels in the Northwest Passage, those kinds of things, sort of broken up, loose bits of ice that are still around. The main core is the central Arctic basin and the area around the North Pole.
And can you describe what happens as we lose the reflective white snow in that basin and replace it with dark blue ocean?
Well, there's a huge decrease in albedo. That's the amount of energy reflected straight back out into space. If you look at fresh snow, its albedo is about 80 to 90%, so nearly everything gets reflected back out. The sort of old snow or old sea ice that's covered with melt pools and rotting away in summer has an albedo of about 0.5 or 0.6. But open water or bare land or forest without snow on it has an albedo of less than 0.1. So there's a massive drop in albedo as soon as you take the snow away or the ice away. And that means that much more energy from the sun is retained by the surface, and that accelerates the warming.
A lot of energy is going into melting the ice. Once the ice is gone, where does that energy go? It's going into the water and accelerating the warming of the ocean.
Yes, once the sea ice has melted, the energy, the solar energy in summer, is absorbed by the water, warms the water up. And in the case of the deep Arctic, the central Arctic Ocean, that's just warming up a thin layer at the surface. But in the case of the continental shelves, which is about a third of the area of the Arctic, you're warming the whole water column, because the water column's only about 50 metres deep. And once you warm the water column, you're warming the seabed, and that's causing problems in accelerating the thawing of subsea permafrost.
And with subsea permafrost thawing, that in turn, what's the effect of that? What's the tangible?
There's been evidence for several years of increasing methane emissions from offshore. That's the work that the Russians have been doing. That's showing a rapid growth in volume of methane, which could become a kind of a pulse sufficient to accelerate climate change. But on a slower time scale, there's melting going on around the whole of the northern hemisphere that's got permafrost on land. That permafrost is thawing, and so there's methane being released or generated by that thawing on a slower scale than the offshore, but ultimately there's more of it because there's such a huge area of permafrost on land to melt. So we'll be seeing, whether we like it or not, a big input of methane into the atmosphere, whether it's rapid from the offshore parts of the Arctic now, or whether it's slower over the next few years and decades from the melting of permafrost on land.
Is there any evidence that longer-term changes in the Earth system due to melting sea ice are starting to become evident, and even if that's outside the Arctic or in the periphery?
Yes, I mean, there's a couple of things. One is sea level rise, that global sea level rise is accelerating. And the predictions are that it will accelerate a lot more because of various effects due to melting ice. Firstly, the warming of the atmosphere in over Greenland, because the sea ice is replaced by water, causes an increase in the melt rate of the Greenland ice sheet. But we're also coming to certain sort of tipping points in Greenland and Antarctica, where the melt of the ice sheet causes the ice sheet to detach itself from the seabed and have big retreats. So the predictions about the glaciological effects of sea ice retreat on the Antarctic and Arctic ice sheets really show that this sea level rise this century is going to be a lot more than the 60 centimetres that IPCC predicts. And James Hansen, for instance, is saying it might be more like 4 metres, which would be catastrophic. And another effect, of course, of sea ice retreat in the Arctic has been this connection with extreme weather events in the Northern Hemisphere generally, and that has an impact on food production because the extreme weather events that we're getting in Europe and in America impinge on the sort of big food-producing temperate regions of the Northern Hemisphere.
These are real impacts that are starting to become.
You are listening to an interview with the Cambridge Glaciology Professor Peter Wadhams. The interviewer is Nick Breeze, a British blogger with a website envisionation.co.uk. I hope the quality of the information makes up for the not-so-great sound of the Skype connection. Here's Nick.
With the effects we've already mentioned contributing to accelerating warming, do you think that we are seeing a self-reinforcing feedback develop in the Arctic where the heating continues regardless of human greenhouse gas emissions?
That's the problem, and the fear of a runaway warming is that when the feedbacks become dominant, then you can have feedback without having to drive it anymore. And already that's almost happening. For instance, if you analyse the extra warming produced by the retreat of sea ice, it's about already been... papers have been published on this, it's about a quarter of the direct effect of adding greenhouse gases. So you add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, you warm the climate, the warming leads to sea ice retreat, but the albedo effect reduction of the sea ice retreat is like adding a quarter to the amount of carbon dioxide you're adding to the atmosphere. And then the retreat of the snow line, which is of the same magnitude, adds another quarter. So we're already, just from Arctic feedbacks, we're adding 50% to the amount of warming that we're getting from the greenhouse gases alone. So the greenhouse gases are the drivers, but the response is much greater than what you'd expect as a direct response to that extra amount of carbon causing extra radiative forcing. So you add on some more feedbacks, and there's a lot more feedbacks around, and you will end up getting an effect which is maybe double what you would get from the heating alone. And you can reach a point where the feedbacks are self-mutually reinforcing to the point where you don't need the original driving force anymore. They'll work together to keep the changes going.
And is that point easy to identify?
No, it's not, but I suspect we're approaching it.
The Met Office often cite the jet stream meandering as the reason for much of the persistent weather patterns, and especially the extreme weather patterns that affect the UK, whether it's long hot spells or long periods of rain. And is there evidence to suggest a link with the Arctic sea ice decline?
Well, yes, I mean, there's a mechanism being proposed for that, whereby the decline of the sea ice causes a change in the circulation, the atmospheric circulation within the polar vortex. That's the region north of the boundary with subpolar air masses, and that causes the jet stream, which is the strong air current at that boundary, to slow down. And slowing down means it develops much bigger meanders, and the meanders don't sort of process around the planet very fast. So you get stuck in a region where there's either a big lobe of cold air coming down where it normally isn't to be found, or you get stuck in a region where there's a lobe of warm air. So you can get persistent anomalous weather patterns at different longitudes around the planet, and that tends to produce horrendous effects as far as food production and disasters like floods and so on.
If the current state of the Arctic is causing global weather disruption, do you think we have now seen the worst of it, or could weather patterns become more unpredictable?
Well, they could become more unpredictable. I mean, for instance, this link between sea ice retreat and the jet stream. There's been studies which show that you can extend that down into the tropical Atlantic, and it's likely that there will be more severe hurricanes occurring. Part of that is also the reduction in the vigour of the thermohaline circulation, so that the heated water in the tropical Atlantic doesn't move up across the Atlantic and up to Europe as well as it did. So we're getting less warming because of that, but you're getting more warming in the tropical Atlantic, so that all the predictions are for more vigorous hurricanes, and of course hurricanes are pretty vigorous anyway at the moment. So you might start having sort of super hurricanes, which are a result of the extra warming of the surface waters in the tropical seas.
What would it take to reverse the melting of the polar ice cap and restore the Arctic sea ice?
Well, I kind of fear you can't do it without reducing the temperature of the entire planet. You can't have a regional effect. Although there's some people think that you can. For instance, the idea of geoengineering, where you can put aerosols into the atmosphere to increase the albedo of the planet, they tend to produce planetary-wide effects. But if you do use another geoengineering technique, which is marine cloud brightening, where you put water, finely divided water particles, into the bottoms of clouds, that selectively whitens clouds in certain regions, and models at least suggest that you might have some control over where you achieve the cooling. So there's some hope that you might be able to achieve a regional cooling with marine cloud brightening, which could bring back some sea ice. I mean, the models show an advance of sea ice if you do your marine cloud brightening in the Northern Hemisphere. So there's one possible mechanism whereby you don't have to cool down the whole planet to bring back the ice. You can cool down regionally using marine cloud brightening.
And are these technologies ready to go?
Everything is just waiting on sufficient seriousness being taken by politicians, that they put lots of money into these key things that can actually have an impact.
You are leaving for the Arctic on a research expedition very shortly. Can you tell us where you're headed, what you're looking for, and who the parties involved are in this expedition?
Well, we're going on the Sikuliak, which is a new icebreaker from the University of Alaska. And we're all partners in a project called Sea State, which is looking at the impact of the open water in the Arctic in causing a feedback which accelerates the loss of ice. And one of the problems is all the observations that anybody's made have been showing the sea ice retreating very fast in summer. The mechanisms that are not put into models, so the modelers say, oh, it can't possibly be retreating that fast because our model says it's not. What that means is the modelers aren't modelling all the physical processes. And one of the processes that could be important is that as the sea ice retreats and you have more open water, you have more wave energy, and the waves interact with the sea ice and break it up so that it melts faster, so that you're getting a marginal ice zone around the edge of the ice, of ice being broken up by waves. And that could be the mechanism which is making the ice retreat faster, and that will make it go faster and faster, because as the sea ice retreats more, you have more and more open water. So we're going up there with a bunch of wave buoys, which we're putting into the ice, monitoring the penetration of waves into ice, how far the waves get, how much ice do they break up. And so we'll be working in the ice edge region, but we might have to go a long way north to find that ice edge. We're leaving from Alaska and we're heading north, so we might have to get quite a long way towards the North Pole before we come into ice that we can work with.
How long do you think you'll be away?
7 weeks.
Do you think the politicians who will meet in Paris in December at the UN climate talks really understand the threat to society from these changes that are going on right now?
I don't think they do, no. Certainly they haven't shown any signs of it up to now, with all the pretty pathetic and useless agreements that have been made up to now, which really have had no impact at all on climate. We're still getting an exponential increase in carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. that's even more exponential than it used to be. So all of the promises of politicians have actually not translated into any action at all. So the track record is terrible. And I think that they don't recognise how absolutely urgent it is to take very, very serious action now. What they think is there's is a sort of let's do plan B, which is we sit here and monitor climate change, and then if we find that it's really getting bad, then we'll start doing something. But the trouble is, it's getting, the effects are accelerating such that if you start taking action in the future, it will be too late because of the ratchet effect of CO2. It lasts such a long time in the atmosphere that if you keep pumping it in, you're going to suffer the consequences for a long time to come, 1,000 years. And so you can't, you have to stop doing that now in order to have a level in the atmosphere which is not going to be catastrophic. So everything has to be done now, but politicians don't have the concept of doing things now because they don't want to upset anybody, they don't want to lose votes. They would always prefer to push it beyond the next election.
Yeah, a politician might say, well, it's extremely complex trying to get everyone to agree to even do one thing. And if you could persuade world leaders to do one thing at this conference, what do you think that one thing would be?
Well, I think it would be to immediately make the top priority everywhere the replacement of fossil fuel use by renewables in concrete ways. I mean, go for seriously going for solar power because it's now cheap and it's effective. It's not a joke anymore, and you can replace a huge amount of our fossil fuel use by solar if you make the effort. And your mentality should no longer be the mentality of coal and oil as the basis of industry or the basis of life. The mentality should be, let's only use energy that is renewable. And if they can take on that, then it is remarkable how quickly we could have a transformation in the world, hopefully.
That was Professor Peter Wadhams. He's professor of ocean physics at the University of Cambridge, UK, with over 40 years of research on Arctic sea ice. He's considered one of the leading experts in his field. He's head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group in the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at Cambridge, the same department where Stephen Hawking is teaching. Wadhams, as you just heard, is considering using geoengineering techniques to halt the Arctic melt because he fears that humanity will not be ready to end the use of fossil fuels within the next 10 to 15 years to cool the planet sufficiently to also halt the melting in the Arctic. Thanks to Nick Breeze for the interview at the end of September 2015. You can watch the YouTube film on the website that he and Brew Pierce set up. envisionation.co.uk is a place to present thoughts, ideas, and interviews on the developing crisis of climate change and our collective and individual response to it. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today we'll be speaking with Sansara Taylor and Reverend Jerome McCory, and I am going to be joining them in New York City next week for an action called Shut Down Rikers. So stay tuned, and Sansara and Reverend McCory will talk about themselves and about the action and why it's imperative that we shut down the Abu Ghraib of America, Rikers Island. Sansara Taylor and Reverend Jerome McCory, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you for having us, Cindy.
Well,
I'm so happy to be with both of you.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Sansara Taylor to tell my listeners a little bit about yourself, and then tell about the action we'll be engaging in next week around Rikers Island in New York City, and about the larger protest Rise Up October.
Okay. Well, as you know, Cindy, and as some of your listeners might know, I am a writer for Revolution Newspaper. I'm a supporter of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and I think I met you a million years ago when we were both working together with the movement to stop the war in Iraq when it was just early on. I was very inspired by what you did, and I've been a part of fighting against all forms of oppression and exploitation, the oppression of women, the oppression and slow genocide against black and brown people, of mass incarceration and police terror, the roundup of immigrants, the destruction of the environment, and yes, the imperialist wars, and fighting for a revolution to get rid of this system and bring into being a whole different liberated world. So that's where I'm coming from, and the revolution that Baba Bakian has been re-envisioning, communist revolution. And so it's taken me in a lot of different directions and a lot of different things. Right now, it brought me together with Reverend Jerome McCory, with the efforts that were initiated by Carl Dixon Cornell West of Rise of October. And Rise of October is three powerful days of political action, mass resistance, to stop police terror, to stop police murder, to stop the mass incarceration of black and brown people, and to say to all of society, which side are you on? Over the last year, there's been tremendous outpourings, uprisings in Ferguson and Baltimore and nationwide against police killings, but the police have not stopped. and the police are never convicted. They're almost never even indicted. And this is something that if you're neutral, you're not really neutral. If you're sitting on the sidelines, you're part of letting this happen.
Right.
And so Rise for October is calling on people. We have to take the resistance higher or else we're complicit. So just fill it out and then hone in on Rikers. October 22nd, 23rd, and 24th are 3 days of action. The 22nd is National Protest Against Police Brutality, and in New York City, a public reading of the names of some of the thousands and thousands who have been murdered by police, shining a light on this epidemic and bringing the families of police murder victims to New York City in the heart of Times Square and having their courageous voices and their grief be heard by the world. That's kicking this off. Then October 23rd, it's a Friday, we're going to be doing nonviolent direct action and protest out at Rikers Island. And for people who may not know, Rikers Island is one of the largest prison jail complexes on the planet. It is a place that houses regularly 14,000 people per night,
wow.
95% of them Black or Latino. 85% of them have never been convicted of a crime. Most of them are held there because they can't make bail. And they're held for years. Many, many people are held for years. Simply because they can't make bail. And 15 people have been killed due to medical neglect there within a five-year period. Just incredible rates of brutality, a whole culture of violence from the guards inflicted on inmates, sexual violence inflicted on the women as well as the men in prison there. It's really the local Abu Ghraib. It's a concentration of the whole network of mass incarceration, and it's right next door to 8 million people who go about their lives as if this is normal. It's our local Dachau, you know. So I think this is a thing where we've said, look, there's been exposures, there's been studies, there's been settlements paid out from the violence and abuse of the guards over and over and over again for decades. It's been exposed, and the time for us to wring our hands and simply condemn it are over. We have to go and we have to put our bodies on the line and say, if you are shackling, if you are starving, if you are torturing our sisters and our brothers behind bars, then it is our responsibility to stand up and put our bodies on the line and say, this must stop. And so it's a key component of Rise Up October. And then the last day of Rise Up October is the 24th, the Saturday, and there's going to be a massive march, people from around the country flooding into the streets to say police terror must stop. And so there's different ways in, and all three of these days will amplify and strengthen each of the rest. But this day of nonviolent direct action with the demand that Rikers be closed down is a very critical dimension, and I'm very honored to be a part of that together with Reverend McCorry and yourself, Cindy, and a number of other reverends and people of conscience.
Sansara, excuse me, what are the particulars of what are the, you know, the the nuts and bolts of the action if people would like to join us?
Yeah, so we're going to be going out. Rikers Island, it's both right in the middle of a major urban metropole, and it's also at the same time extremely isolated. And so you have to take a bus out to Queens, you have to take a train out to Queens, and you have to take a bus, and you have to get on the Rikers bus to get all the way to go and visit a loved one in Rikers. So what we're going to do is we are going to take the public transportation, we're going to rally people out at the Queens entrance to Rikers Island. We're going to hold a protest there, and it'll be Friday morning, the 23rd, I believe it'll be 11. We're nailing down the exact details, and we'll be announcing it at riseupoctober.org, all the details. And we're going to have people who gather, who rally. We're going to have the Raging Grannies singing. We're going to have people doing prayers, and then we're going to have people who want to put themselves on the line to make a strong statement that Rikers Island must be shut down are gonna find a way to express that sentiment.
Can I say this? Is this an action where it may be possible that the people who participate in the direct action Even though we're out there exercising our supposed constitutional rights to freedom of expression, freedom of speech, is it possible that it could be risking arrest?
Well, I think it's definitely the case that when people stand up against injustice, and especially against the jaws of mass incarceration and torture and brutality, that that the authorities in the state don't like that.
Right.
And I think I will speak for myself, and I think I speak for others who have signed this call for nonviolent direct action, that we will not allow the state to deprive us of our right to make that statement very strongly and with determination. And if they, you know, if they had the illegitimate intention of arresting or stopping people, we don't intend to let them stop us. So I'll put it that way.
Okay, great. Thank you, Sansara. So Reverend McCory,
you're welcome.
Reverend McCory, tell my listeners a little bit about yourself and why you're participating in this call and in the direct action, direct nonviolent action, I should say.
Well, first of all, I'm a longtime civil rights organizer. I've been involved for a number of years with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. I've also been involved nationally with a number of other organizations. And as you can imagine, we include here as to attach ourselves to a number of issues and other things that are going across this nation. For about 2 years, I served as the faith coordinator for the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, co-founded by Cornel West and Carl Dix. And when the whole concept and the idea for Rise Up October came about, I immediately came on board in that capacity and began to galvanize, first of all, the faith community around these issues. It is my earnest belief that we have a moral imperative to make a difference in the lives of others. Being at the front line, on the front line of situations such as the kinds of police terror that we have seen lately in our communities, having served as spokesman for families, for instance, like Tamir Rice, John Crawford III, and others across the nation, put us right on the front line of this issue. But for us, the bottom line is all of those elements that make up mass incarceration. And let me say right away, though we use the terminology mass incarceration, the truth of the matter is there is no mass incarceration. What we have is selective incarceration. Mm-hmm. Mass incarceration means all of your citizens in a particular are being targeted.
Right.
Selective incarceration means that there's some specifications, such as people of color who are being targeted, such as poor folk who are being targeted. So we have selective incarceration, but we use the term mass incarceration. And when you look at Rikers particularly, and I'm so glad that Sansara was great about bringing that out, perhaps the worst institution in the United States is, in fact, Rikers Island. Where better to take some direct action than Rikers Island? But I think in coming to New York, period, for me goes a little further, because folks have asked me, why New York, say, versus D.C.?
Mm-hmm.
Number one, I tell them, we've been to D.C. so many times,
right,
and that hasn't worked out well for us lately. But the other thing, not only is New York a capital city of the entire world, but New York is really home to the United Nations. And the United States has been great historically at leveling charges against other nations for the treatment of its own citizens and primarily charging them with acts of inhumane treatment of their own citizens. And we think those other nations have an opportunity to flip the script and now look at the United States, and perhaps it's time to indict this nation for the inhumane treatment of its citizens of color. So we think it's significantly important that we come to New York and that we come ready to make a statement. And so we're looking at taking this direct action where Rikers is concerned, but coming to New York in general, because we think it is a capital city of the entire world, and it's an idea whose time has come. So this was easy for me to buy into.
Well, thank you so much. And like I said, I'm really looking forward to coming out there, flying across the country, being with you all in these important actions. I hope that many people join us, and I hope that we, seems like this movement has, you know, it hasn't stopped police killings, it hasn't stopped mass incarceration, but it's brought really to the forefront these issues, and people are starting to talk about the disproportionate, you know, killing of people of color by police. And it also has achieved some victory in some indictments and things like that. So I think it's very important. It's a very important issue to be involved in. But Sansara, is there anything that you'd like to add, anything that you'd like my listeners to know before we end this interview?
Yeah, I guess I'd like to just add one thought to what you were just mentioning, which is, it's true. This movement has not stopped the police from killing. They are still killing. They're still killing every single day. And I agree absolutely with what Reverend McCrory just said. It's selective killing. It's terror and murder and brutality and tasing and stomping. Black and brown people, women as well as men, but especially men, it's just rampant.
Right.
And actually, the fact that our movement has not stopped it is why we need to stand up even more.
Yes.
A lot of times people look at things, and I think it's really important to understand, this country was founded on slavery. This country went through 100 years of Jim Crow, lynch mob terror. This country has deep-seated white supremacy, and now it's in the new Jim Crow. Mass incarceration of black and brown people, police terror, all of this. And the idea that it's going to be ended because people say, oh, we don't like it. A lot of people haven't liked it for a long time.
Right.
It's going to take a fight. And that's not a reason why a movement didn't stop it in a year. It's not a reason to say, oh, it didn't work. It's a reason to step it up. And that's exactly what Rise Up October is. And it's exactly why it's an idea whose time has come. And it's actually even more important now because people are paying attention, because people's hopes have been raised, because society has been shaken, because people around the world are looking now to what's going to happen. This is the moment we either step it up or we squander a moment. There has not been struggle against this form of terror and racist oppression on the level that we've seen in the last year. This hasn't happened in decades. And it's a precious moment. It's a moment that is fraught with dangers. There's a counterattack. There's repression. There's all kinds of things going on to change the subject and let the killing intensify, but it's a moment where if we have courage and we have determination and we tell the truth and we step up and put ourselves on the line, and call on everybody. I mean it when I say there is no neutral. It's not enough to hate the videos that come out every single day. It's not enough. You have to act to stop them. But if we act to stop them, and there is a critical mass coming together in Rise Up October, and everybody listening has a choice you now have to make, to get on the bus, get on the plane, come to New York, donate funds at riseupoctober.org to sponsor the families who are traveling here of police murder victims, to sponsor the buses, to sponsor the stage, to get the materials out. Your financial support and your material participation, these things matter. History turns on them, and nothing has ever changed without a huge struggle. And that's what we're prepared to lead right now, and everybody has a role to play. So I invite you, and I urge you, there's a million things we could say more than what we've had a chance to cover, but join with us and be part of this, and we'll continue the dialogue as we stand up together. Go to riseupoctober.org, go to redcom.us, and you can see what the Revolutionary Communist Party is saying about all of this, and join with us. We have a tremendous moral obligation, and we have an opportunity right now, so join with us.
I just have one point to make, and maybe Reverend McCrory can comment on this. If it is a disproportionate amount of black and brown people being murdered by the cops, by killer cops, and if they're not being murdered, they're actually being preyed upon in a disproportionate amount by recruiters and being lured into the military-industrial complex
So it seems like people of color are targeted for this imperial violence, whether it's on the streets of the United States or the streets of some faraway country that the empire is bombing or asking our young people to kill, other people, mostly of color in other countries. So, Reverend McCorry, that's a little bit off the subject, but I don't think, as somebody who has been connected to this since my son was killed in Iraq 11 years ago, do you have a comment about that?
Yeah, absolutely I do. And that's plain and simply put. One of the things that gets used so often against people of color happens to be the economic status that exists in this country.
Yes.
When you're at the bottom of the totem pole, you are targeted for anything that has that is even remotely violent or really dysfunctional in its very nature. Because of the economic situation, we get pushed into a situation where we will almost do anything for a dollar, thus going to the military. We have parents, and it makes me cringe to hear a parent say to a young man today, you can go to the military and you'll learn discipline. Oh, goodness, if you have to go to the military to learn how to take care of yourself, it's really a problem somewhere.
Yes, yes.
But these are the kinds of messages that have caused especially black and brown communities to be targeted by the military-industrial complex and by others who would dare to promote violence, especially against other people. We also live in a nation that if you don't think the way that I think and you come from another country, we're taught then that automatically makes you the enemy. And that's another way that we get preyed upon, and we've got to absolutely educate people against that. It is so important that we show up then in these mass numbers, that we go to New York, but not just to have another march, and not just for another rally, but that there's education that goes on. And I think the second part of that is this. October the 22nd through the 24th must be more than another action. It must be the beginning of real systemic change in this nation. It is time to change this nation. And we talk about the involvement of who some of those organizations are, but I say to people, how dare we sit in temples and mosques and churches on Saturdays and Sundays and not come to the streets and engage in fixing clearly what's broken in our communities and what's going on around us? We, again, have it as a moral imperative. I say to my white brothers and sisters, it is because we are being targeted in the black and brown community doesn't mean that it's limited to us. Joseph Lowery got it exactly right. The old leader of the SCLC, what he said, what's in the best interest of any nation's targeted population among the poorest folk and people of color, it's in the best interest of all people. And so he explains it in this way. We have to work until white becomes right, till black won't have to get back, till brown can stick around, yellow becomes mellow, and until the red man can get ahead, man. It's in the best interest of all of us to work together. And this is why Rise Up is so important. This is why we must engage, and it must be a beginning and not an end. The other question I often get asked is, how in the world does a Christian community engage in this kind of work with the Revolutionary Communist Party or with this group over here or that group over there? And I tell people, here again, America teaches us to focus on the numerators because the numerators will keep us forever divided. But the common denominator is what's going on in this country. It's everybody's business, and we've got to find that common denominator, which is those killer cops are not asking us what we belong to before they shoot us down. And so we have to fight back. We have to do it together. Together is always better, and it takes teamwork to make the dream work. And I'm tired of sleeping through the dream. It's time that we start dealing with some realities. And I sincerely believe that you cannot fix a police department, for an example, or a militaristic system because you put more people of color in it. The only color police understand, for instance, is the color blue. Doesn't matter whether the officer's black, brown, yellow, white. It's a mindset. Modern-day policing, as well as our military, quite frankly, is the outgrowth of the old slave catchers. It is the outgrowth of the militia. It is the outgrowth of the National Guard that was always designed to target poor and minority folks. And so you cannot fix it because you fill it up with poor and minority folks. You have to destroy that system literally and come up with a whole new system. You can never build anything on a rotten and decaying foundation. You got to tear the foundation down.
I just thought of a smart aleck comment. Won't electing another Democrat fix it? Just kidding.
That's so. You really don't want me to throw on that.
I know, we've seen that movie. It is a little dizzying. We've seen that movie. Everybody gets delirious and they get amnesia. Because last night we had the debates. We're recording right the morning after the debates, and everybody's all excited. And I'm like, didn't you see this movie with Obama? Didn't you see this? And then he became the deporter-in-chief, the mass incarceration-in-chief, the droner-in-chief, right. All of this. It's time we get out of that. So I don't want to start us on another conversation.
I know, that would be another
really
hour.
Agree.
that would be at least
I agree, and I really appreciate what Reverend McCory was just speaking of, too. So,
it was really wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for this conversation, and I'm looking forward to being there with you next week. Sansara Taylor and Reverend Jerome McCory, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. RiseUpOctober.org. Let's go there and let's go to New York City next week. Thank you. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. We appreciate all you do.
Okay. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
That's Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox today. I hope you go to riseupoctober.org for more information about the events in New York City next week and also about shutting down Rikers Island. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar. I'd like to thank Sansara Taylor and Reverend Jerome McCory for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox this week and for their continuing work for peace and justice and accountability. And I'd like to thank you for listening to and supporting Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.